Welcome back to continuing live coverage of the Democratic National Convention 2008, live from the Pepsi Center in Denver, Colorado. Mark Levine is your host on the ground at the Pepsi Center. Let's go to Mark right away.
Hey, Bob. I think what they're doing is killing time. You know, it's I don't know what time you have. I got 2 minutes till the top of the hour.
No, no. It's 46 seconds past the top.
You know, I got that program, Bob. I don't know. In any case, whatever they're doing, they are certainly waiting for Bill Clinton. In fact, they're even inserting speakers. This is a member of Congress, I think, from Florida. You know, they're killing time, waiting for the grand entrance of Bill Clinton. And at this point, every seat in the hall is full. There are a number of people standing in the aisles. This is the big moment of the evening. There are two big moments. There's Bill Clinton and, of course, Joe Biden. These are the two moments that will be replayed on the news channels. These are the parts where ABC, CBS, and NBC will finally come away from, you know, who knows what, American Idol or whatever reality show, and actually show the Democratic National Convention.
But you know what, Mark? There were 22.3 million viewers for Monday night's programming, so that's pretty good.
No way! 22.3, that's very high. Particularly because, you know, Michelle Obama. I mean, that was not... I love Michelle Obama,
that's the draw. She was the draw.
Really? I guess they want to know who she is. It's interesting because, you know, generally in a convention, and statistics back up on this. Wait a minute. Here's Bill Clinton. We'll get right to the convention hall. Here he comes. Here's Bill. Lots of American flags waving in the hall. God, I love that song.
To be here tonight. Please stop. Thank you. Please stop. Sit down. Sit down. Thank you. Please sit. Please sit. You know, I love this, and I thank you, but we have important work to do tonight. I am here first to support Barack Obama. And second, I'm here to warm up the crowd for Joe Biden. Though, as you will soon see, he doesn't need any help from me. I love Joe Biden, and America will too. What a year we Democrats have had. The primary began with an all-star lineup, and it came down to two remarkable Americans locked in a hard-fought contest right to the very end. That campaign generated so much heat, it increased global warming. Now, in the end, my candidate didn't win, but I'm really proud of the campaign she ran. I am proud that she never quit on the people she stood up for, on the changes she pushed for, on the future she wanted for all our children. And I'm grateful for the chance Chelsea and I had to go all over America to tell people about the person we know and love. Now, I am not so grateful for the chance to speak in the wake of Hillary's magnificent speech last night. But I'll do the best I can. Last night, Hillary told us in no uncertain terms that she is going to do everything she can to elect Barack Obama. That makes two of us. Actually, that makes 18 million of us. Because, like Hillary, I want all of you who supported her to vote for Barack Obama in November. And here's why. And I have the privilege of speaking here, thanks to you, from a perspective that no other American Democrat except President Carter can offer. Our nation is in trouble on two fronts. The American dream is under siege at home, and America's leadership in the world has been weakened. Middle-class and low-income Americans are hurting, with incomes declining, job losses, poverty and inequality rising, mortgage foreclosures and credit card debt increasing, health care coverage disappearing, and a very big spike in the cost of food, utilities, and gasoline. And our position in the world has been weakened by too much unilateralism and too little cooperation. By a perilous dependence on imported oil, by a refusal to lead on global warming, by a growing indebtedness and a dependence on foreign lenders, by a severely burdened military, by a backsliding on global nonproliferation and arms control agreements, and by a failure to consistently use the power of diplomacy. From the Middle East to Africa to Latin America to Central and Eastern Europe. Clearly, the job of the next president is to rebuild the American dream and to restore American leadership in the world. And here's what I have to say about that. Everything I learned in my 8 years as president, and in the work I have done since in America and across the globe, has convinced me that Barack Obama is the man for this job. Now, he has a remarkable ability to inspire people, to raise our hopes and rally us to high purpose. He has the intelligence and curiosity every successful president needs. His policies on the economy, on taxes, on health care, on energy are far superior to the Republican alternatives. He has shown a clear grasp of foreign policy and national security challenges, and a firm commitment to rebuild our badly strained military. His family heritage and his life experiences have given him a unique capacity to lead our increasingly diverse nation in an ever more interdependent world. The long, hard primary tested and strengthened him. And in his first presidential decision, the selection of a running mate, he hit it out of the park. With Joe Biden's experience and wisdom, supporting Barack Obama's proven understanding, instincts, and insight, America will have the national security leadership we need. And so, my fellow Democrats, I say to you, Barack Obama is ready to lead America and to restore American leadership in the world. Barack Obama is ready to honor the oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Barack Obama is ready to be President of the United States. President, he will work for an America with more partners and fewer adversaries. He will rebuild our frayed alliances and revitalize the international institutions which help to share the cost of the world's problems and to leverage the power of our influence. He will put us back in the forefront of the world's fight against global warming and the fight to reduce nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. He will continue and enhance our nation's commendable global leadership in an area in which I am deeply involved, the fight against AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, including, and this is very important, a renewal of the battle against HIV and AIDS here at home. A President Obama will choose diplomacy first and military force as a last resort. But in a world troubled by terror, by trafficking in weapons, drugs, and people, by human rights abuses of the most awful kind, by other threats to our security, our interests, and our values, when he cannot convert adversaries into partners, he will stand up to them. Barack Obama also will not allow the world's problems to obscure its opportunities. everywhere in rich and poor countries alike. Hardworking people need good jobs, secure, affordable health care, food and energy, quality education for their children, and economically beneficial ways to fight global warming. These challenges cry out for American ideas and American innovation. When Barack Obama unleashes them, America will save lives, win new allies, open new markets, and create wonderful new jobs for our own people. Most important of all, Barack Obama knows that America cannot be strong abroad unless we are first strong at home. People the world over have always been more impressed by the power of our example than by the example of our power. The example the Republicans have set. In this decade, American workers have consistently given us rising productivity. That means year after year they work harder and produce more. Now, what did they get in return? Declining wages, less than one-fourth as many new jobs as in the previous 8 years, smaller health care and pension benefits, rising poverty, and the biggest increase in income inequality since the 1920s. American families, by the millions, are struggling with soaring health care costs and declining coverage. I will never forget the parents of children with autism and other serious conditions who told me on the campaign trail that they couldn't afford health care and couldn't qualify their children for Medicaid unless they quit work and starved or got a divorce. Are these the family values the Republicans are so proud of? What about the military families pushed to the breaking point by multiple deployments? What about the assault on science and the defense of torture? What about the war on unions and the unlimited favors for the well-connected? And what about Katrina and cronyism? My fellow Democrats, America can do better than that. And Barack Obama will do better than that. Wait a minute. But first, yes, he can, but first we have to elect him. The choice is clear. The Republicans in a few days will nominate a good man who has served our country heroically and who suffered terribly in a Vietnamese prison camp. He loves his country every bit as much as we do. As a senator, he has shown his independence of right-wing orthodoxy on some very important issues. But on the two great questions of this election, how to rebuild the American dream and how to restore America's leadership in the world, he still embraces the extreme philosophy that has defined his party for more than 25 years. And it is, to be fair to all the Americans who aren't as hardcore Democrats as we. It's a philosophy the American people never actually had a chance to see in action fully until 2001, when the Republicans finally gained control of both the White House and the Congress. Then we saw what would happen to America if the policies they had talked about for decades actually were implemented. And look what happened. They took us from record surpluses to an exploding debt, from over 22 million new jobs to just 5 million, from increasing working families' incomes to nearly $7,500 a year to a decline of more than $2,000 a year, from almost 8 million Americans lifted out of poverty to more than 5.5 million driven into poverty, and millions more losing their health insurance. Now, in spite of all this evidence, their candidate is actually promising more of the same. Think about it. More tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans that will swell the deficit, increase inequality, and weaken the economy. More band-aids for health care that will enrich insurance companies, impoverish families, and increase the number of uninsured. More going it alone in the world instead of building the shared responsibilities and shared opportunities necessary to advance our security and restore our influence. They actually want us to reward them for the last 8 years by giving them four more. Now, let's send them a message that will echo from the Rockies all across America. A simple message. Thanks, but no thanks. In this case, the third time is not the charm. My fellow Democrats, 16 years ago, you gave me the profound honor to lead our party to victory and to lead our nation to a new era of peace and broadly shared prosperity. Together, we prevailed in a hard campaign in which the Republicans said I was too young and too inexperienced to be commander-in-chief. Sound familiar? It didn't work in 1992. Because we were on the right side of history. And it will not work in 2008 because Barack Obama is on the right side of history. Now, Senator Obama's life is a 21st century incarnation of the old-fashioned American dream. His achievements are proof of our continuing progress toward the more perfect union of our founders' dreams. The values of freedom and equal opportunity, which have given him his historic chance, will drive him as president to give all Americans, regardless of race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or disability, their chance to build a decent life and to show our humanity as well as our strength to the world. We see that humanity, that strength, and our nation's future in Barack and Michelle Obama and their beautiful children. We see them reinforced by the partnership with Joe Biden, his fabulous wife Jill, a wonderful teacher, and their family. Barack Obama will lead us away from the division and fear of the last 8 years, back to unity and hope. So, if, like me, you believe America must always be a place called hope, then join join Hillary and Chelsea and me in making Barack Obama the next president of the United States. Thank you, and God bless you.
You've heard that old line about what is the sound of one hand clapping? I think you just heard the sound of Mark Levine's two hands clapping. Takes a lot to make Mark Levine clap.
Maybe so. You know, I keep hearing that song, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, and I think back to 1992, and I think back to the hopes and the dreams and the thinking that finally in my life, first time in my life, I had a president that I voted for.
Yeah, he was my first winner too.
In my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't stop thinking about tomorrow. There was this hope. There was this possibility, and I'll always like Bill Clinton. You know,
look,
the man's not perfect. People go over his imperfections all the time, but he was the best president of my lifetime.
Well, I'll tell you what, Sherman, set the Wayback Machine for 22nd Amendment. Honest to God, if the 22nd Amendment wasn't in place, Mark, don't you feel certain that he would have run for a third term?
And easily beaten George Bush. Easily.
Oh, George wouldn't have run against him.
They have nobody. What would they do? Just capitulate?
Oh, you know, run Bob Dole or Dan Quayle. You know, put up some cipher, some placeholder.
I mean, you know, the nice thing about Bill Clinton is he makes his case. I mean, he in a lawyerly fashion, one by one, economics. I mean, when he said, I'll tell you what the biggest applause line was, other than, you know, at the end and the exciting thing, it was, oh, hold on, let me get the exact line, because I don't want to mess it up. Hold on, I got the speech right here. Give me
all right.
It was the power of example line, but I want to read it exactly as he said. Here it is. People the world over have always been more impressed by the power of our example than by the example of our power.
There is one of those in every one of his speeches. You know, just that,
there
that,
really is. There's one line.
That little crystalline thing.
I miss those years. You know, the 90s seems so far away. I mean, the country had such good economic times. We had such a high surplus. The only war we had, the one in Kosovo, was to stop genocide, and we didn't lose a single American life to enemy fire. And times were so good that the only thing the Republicans could think to criticize was our president's sex life. Remember those days?
That's all they had.
How many decades ago was it? Was that really just a decade ago?
No, it was more than a decade ago. You know, the Clinton administration was winding down by 10 years ago. But we are, you know, we're and see, that was the you know what, you talk about the hope. The reason I think part of the reason that hope was there beyond the sheer Clinton mystique, Mark, is the fact that a lot of us were coming into our adulthood then. You and I are roughly the same age.
Yeah.
And we had watched our youth be, let me be a little crass, we'd watched our youth be pissed on by Ronald Reagan and George I.
Absolutely.
With
you know, I remember how much I hated George Bush Sr. I thought he was the worst president in American history. I really did. And you know what? Up until that time in my life, he probably was. And then came his son. And in contrast, I don't know, the elderly Bush seems not so bad.
And see, that's the point that I keep trying to make with regard to McCain. Looking back now, Poppy Bush seems positively reasonable. Okay?
He really does.
Looking back from the vantage point of George W. Bush and the 8 tortured years that we've had to deal with that pig-eyed, jug-eared little monkey in the office, Richard Nixon looks pretty appealing.
Nixon was a liberal compared to these
Republicans. By these standards, he was.
Environmental protection, windfall profits type things, protecting
OSHA.
There you go. Safety for workers.
The only president ever to propose a national living wage.
Right. Right. Now, don't get me wrong.
I mean, yeah, this is not the Nixon Appreciation Society by any stretch of the imagination.
But compared to the present day, he'd be considered a liberal. He'd be thrown out of the Republican Party.
But Mark, the point that I'm working toward here is this theme that I've been trying to sort of get into the consciousness, and that is, we can look back fondly now. Well, okay, not fondly, but we can look back and say, you know, yeah, Poppy was better. You know, Nixon was better.
Reagan was better.
Okay, but I'm going to drop a bomb on you. As loathsome, as subhuman as George W. Bush appears and has behaved, if John McCain gets into the White House, mark my words, Mark, we will find ourselves saying, dear God, he was smarter than we thought. John McCain is actually more stupid than George Bush.
Is that possible, Bob? I mean, I just don't know that there are levels you can go below.
Yeah, well, yeah, but it is possible. I mean, I heard you talking, I guess it was yesterday, about grade inflation in the Ivy League.
Yeah.
And, you know, John Kerry and George W. Bush both got their fair share of gentlemen C's at Yale.
And a C in the Ivy League, let's face it, is an F anywhere else. It just is. I admit it. I was there. It is.
So if you showing up is good for a C?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
You know, I actually had to work for my bad grades.
Don't get me wrong. It's still quite hard to get an A. Let's just say there's a huge range between B+ and B-.
Right. But anyway, the point that I'm trying to make here, though, is that they got their, both he and John Kerry got their fair share of gentlemen C's, but John McCain went to Annapolis, and that's and I call him Old 894 for a reason. Not just because it sounds like a tired old steam-driven locomotive that desperately should be needs to be retired, but because 894 out of 899. And before anybody says anything to me, Mark, I also freely admit that they say that his grades were worse because
I have to interrupt you. I'm afraid we probably should hear John Kerry, whether we like it or not. Don't you think?
Oh, is it that time already?
Here he is.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
My friends.
4 years ago, you gave me the honor of fighting our fight. And I was proud to stand with you then, and I am proud to stand with you now to help elect Barack Obama president of the United States.
Yeah, that's the thing, Mark. We gave him the chance to do that fight, and then he didn't fight.
We came so close to victory. Well, my friends, we are even closer now, and let me tell you, this time we're going to win. Today, the call for change is more powerful than ever, and with more seats in Congress, with more people, with more passion in our politics, and with a President Obama, we stand on the brink of the greatest opportunity of our generation to move this country forward. The stakes could not be higher. Because we do know what a McCain administration would look like. There's a slip. It would look just like the past, just like George Bush, and this country can't afford a third Bush term. Just think. John McCain voted with George Bush 90% of the time. 90% of George Bush, my friends, is just more than we can take. Never in modern history has an administration squandered American power so recklessly. Never has strategy been so replaced by ideology. Never has extremism so crowded out common sense and fundamental American values. Never has short-term partisan politics so depleted the strength of America's bipartisan foreign policy. George Bush and John McCain at his side promised to spread freedom but they delivered the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time. They misread the threat and misled the country. Instead of freedom, it's Hamas, Hezbollah, the Taliban, and dictators everywhere that are on the march. North Korea can build more bombs, and Iran is defiantly chasing one. Our mission is to restore America's influence and position in the world. And we must use all the weapons in our arsenal, above all, our values. President Obama and Vice President Biden will shut down Guantanamo, respect the Constitution, and make clear once and for all, the United States of America does not torture, not now, not ever. We must listen. We must listen and lead by example, because even a nation as powerful as the United States needs some friends in this world. We need a leader who understands all of our security challenges, not just bombs and guns, but global warming, global terror, and global AIDS. And Barack Obama understands there is no way for America to be secure until we create clean energy here at home. Not with a little more oil in 10 or 20 or 30 years, but with an energy revolution that begins now. I have known and been friends with John McCain for almost 22 years. But every day now I learn something new about candidate McCain. To those who still believe in the myth of a maverick instead of the reality of a politician, I say, let's compare Senator McCain to candidate McCain. Candidate McCain now supports the very wartime tax cuts that Senator McCain once called irresponsible. Candidate McCain criticizes Senator McCain's own climate change bill. Candidate McCain says he would vote against the immigration bill that Senator McCain wrote. Are you kidding me, folks? Talk about being for it before you're against it. Let me tell you, before he ever debates Barack Obama, John McCain should finish the debate with himself. And what's more, Senator McCain, who once railed against the smears of Karl Rove when he was the target, has morphed into candidate McCain, who is using the same Rove tactics, the same Rove staff, the same old politics of fear and smear.
No!
Well, not this year, not this time. The Rove McCain tactics are old and outworn, and America will reject them in 2008. So remember, when we choose a commander-in-chief this November, we are electing judgment and character, not years in the Senate or on this earth. Time and again, Barack Obama has seen farther and listened harder and listened better and thought harder. And time and again, Barack Obama has proven right. John McCain stood on the deck of an aircraft carrier just 3 months after 9/11, and he proclaimed, "Next up, Baghdad." The judgment immediately from Barack Obama was to see an occupation of undetermined length, undetermined consequences, undetermined cost that, in his words, would only fan the flames of the Middle East. Well, guess what? Mission accomplished. So, who can we trust to keep America safe? When Barack Obama promised to honor the best traditions of both parties and talk to our enemies, John McCain scoffed. George Bush called it the false comfort of appeasement. But today, Bush's diplomats are doing exactly what Obama said, talking with Iran. So who can we trust to keep America safe? When democracy rolled out of Russia and the tanks rolled into Georgia, we saw John McCain immediately respond with outdated thinking of the Cold War. Barack Obama responded like a true friend of Georgia and a statesman of the 21st century. So who can we trust to keep America safe?
Barack Obama.
When Democrats called for a timetable to make Iraqis stand up for Iraq and bring our heroes home, John McCain called it cut and run. But today, even President Bush has seen the light, and he and Prime Minister Maliki agree on, guess what? A timetable. So who can we trust to keep America safe?
Barack Obama.
The McCain-Bush Republicans have been wrong again and again and again. And they know they will lose on the issues. So, the candidate who once campaigned on the promise of a campaign of ideas, not insults, now has nothing left but personal attacks. How insulting to suggest that those who question the mission question the troops. How pathetic to suggest that those who question a failed policy doubt America itself. How desperate to tell the son of a single mother who chose community service over money and privilege that he doesn't put America first. No one. No one can question Barack. No one can question Barack Obama's patriotism. Like all of us, he was taught what it means to be an American by his family. His grandmother, who worked on a bomber assembly line in World War II, his grandfather, who marched in Patton's army, and his great-uncle, who enlisted in the army right out of high school at the height of the war. And on a spring day in 1945, that great-uncle helped liberate one of the concentration camps at Buchenwald. Ladies and gentlemen, Barack Obama's uncle is here with us tonight. Please join me in saluting this American hero, Charlie Payne. Charlie, your nephew, Barack Obama, will end this politics of distortion and division. He will be a president who seeks not to perfect the lies of swift voting, but to end them once and for all. This election is a chance for America to tell the merchants of fear and division, you don't decide who loves this country. You don't decide who is a patriot. You don't decide whose service counts and whose doesn't. Four years ago, I said, and I say it again tonight, that flag that hangs from the rafters and that you have waved here this evening, that flag doesn't belong to any ideology. It doesn't belong to any political party. It is an enduring symbol of our nation, and it belongs to all the American people. After all, patriotism is not love of power or some trick. Patriotism is love of country. Years ago, when we protested a war, people would weigh in against us, saying, my country, right or wrong. Our answer, absolutely, my country, right or wrong. When right, keep it right, and when wrong, make it right. Sometimes loving your country demands that you must tell the truth to power. This is one of those times, and Barack Obama is telling those truths. In closing, let me say, I will always remember how we stood together in 2004, the largest number of Democrats in American history, not just in a campaign, but for a cause. Now again, we stand together in the ranks, ready to fight. The choice is clear, our cause is just, and now is the time to make Barack Obama President of the United States of America. Thank you.
Bob, I'm going to do something I don't do very often. I'm going to praise John Kerry. That was a heck of a speech.
I get all wistful, Mark. You know what I mean?
I mean, those lines. I mean, you know.
Where was that guy 4 years ago?
He was under a Swift boat.
I mean, it's like Return of the Body Snatchers. It's like they put the pod under his bed and the hey, that guy could have won an election.
Huh. You know, I don't know whether he was surprised at the time by the viciousness of the lies and he just was stunned and couldn't believe they would go so low.
No, because see, look, when I'm stunned, I don't go windsurfing.
No, he was windsurfing before the swift boats. Come on, the ads were after, but the swift boating was,
yeah.
was like in May.
No, it was just the terrible, terrible Democratic campaign management. Let's admit it. I mean, look. Was it
Bob Schrum, that great campaign manager?
Yeah, the guy that's a millionaire from doing that. You know, he's the political equivalent of the Washington Generals, you know, getting their ass handed to him by the Harlem Globetrotters.
But Bob, he only lost 19 campaigns. I'm sure he'll win the 20th.
Yeah, that's the guy at the craps table. Yeah, my luck's going to break.
Well, thank God for David Axelrod.
It was the windsurfing. It was the photo of him in the sperm suit. You know,
that shouldn't decide elections.
No, it shouldn't. And neither should pictures of little short Massachusetts governors in tanks either. But they do.
You know, people wear funny hats and all kinds of...
Well, no, I respect the people who have to wear that clothing. We've got a legitimate, honest-to-God rocket scientist who listens to this program who occasionally has to don one of those things. And, you know, it's how you get the job done. But if you want to be president of the United States, you don't let yourself be photographed in it.
You know, Kerry accomplished a lot in that speech. He's really the perfect person to attack McCain, largely because, let's face it, you may remember 4 years ago, Democrats don't like to talk about this, but it is widely believed, and I think the evidence is pretty clear, that Kerry offered McCain a vice presidential thing. Doesn't that seem ages ago? But as he points out, and I think he was actually trying to justify that backhandedly to the crowd, as he points out, candidate McCain was very different from Senator McCain. McCain has gone, I mean, I don't know which is the real McCain, but I do know that he is now clearly George Bush III. That's how he's presenting himself.
I don't know if McCain knows who the real McCain is. I don't know if the real McCain exists, Mark.
Well, probably not.
Because the real McCain has been looking for himself since the day he emerged from his mother's womb, and I'm not being nasty. Because, you know, I said a little bit ago that this guy could actually be worse than Bush. Consider, he's got the same sort of Oedipal sort of, you know, I gotta do better than daddy thing going on that Bush had. Because among other things, McCain's father and grandfather were literally fleet command officers in the United States Navy. And, you know, you just don't get that commission out of the gumball machine. It ain't there. When coming out of Annapolis, it was clear he was never going to be that guy.
Yeah, when you... 99% of the class does better than you, and you're not at the top of that last 1%.
Yeah, not that I'm some sort of elitist. For God's sakes, I graduated from Harvard on the Mon, okay? I mean, no.
You know, is 50% too much to ask that he be average? Is that too much to ask?
Well, you know, if old 894 should actually be elected, please, every god, please, no. But if he should, he will make our second Naval Academy graduate president. You know?
Okay.
You didn't.
I think Carter was the first, right?
Yep. Jimmy Carter, 47th out of a class of 900.
Lot better.
Yeah.
Lot better.
And turns out, a lot smarter.
Then there's Barack Obama, who was the head of the Harvard Law Review. So that might even be.
Yeah, they don't pass those out in the gumball machines either.
No, they sure don't. They sure don't. Another thing that people don't often know about Barack Obama is that he did not tell Harvard he was African-American. Very interesting. Didn't use that. We have Bill Richardson coming up. He ran for president. He got fourth. I think we should. Oh, no. It's not him. Excuse me. He will be coming up, but we're not there yet. They you know what they do with this schedule? They don't follow it every single person. I apologize. It's somebody else.
No, that's because we're Democrats. They spend a year putting the schedule together, and then they throw it away. Well, we're done with the schedule. We can chuck it out the window now because we're Democrats.
When we get to Bill Richardson, I'd like to hear him.
I do, too. I agree with you. He's an incredibly decent man. It's being pointed out in the chat room. Jimmy Carter went under the North Pole in a nuclear submarine. And, you know, John McCain tried to get there via a pond in Hanoi.
Before we go on, though, I need to say what an incredible speech that was. I mean, John Kerry roused this room, and he didn't do it at the beginning of the speech. I was like, oh, there goes John Kerry again. I said it myself. I admit it.
My friends.
Poor guy. He's trying.
Welcome to the stage, Herman Munster.
But this wasn't that speech, Bob. This wasn't that speech. When he talked about the Swift boats, he did not hang back. He talked about Karl Rove. I'm proud to say, as I told the chat room, I began the booze in the hall when they mentioned Karl Rove. I am a little proud of that. I told Bob earlier, I came within 10 feet of Karl Rove today, and I could feel this black aura of evil over me. And I have to say, I am not a man of violence. I truly am not. But he had only one bodyguard with him, and it did cross my mind that I could do physical damage to Karl Rove. I wouldn't be able to kill him, but I could.
And we'd have bailed you out as soon as we found you.
I'm afraid I'd be dead, Bob. But I thought about it. I did. I crossed my mind. I have never, you know, look, I've seen George W. Bush in public. I've seen him when he did State of the Union speeches, and I ain't no Bush fan. But I didn't feel the way I felt standing 10 feet from Karl Rove. That man is pure evil. He's pure, and he should be in jail. One of my big hopes is that when Barack Obama becomes president of the United States, that we actually investigate. John Conyers will be free to do what he wants. There'll be no impeachment problem.
We'll put
him in jail.
In the short time we have available to us, because I never know when Richardson's going to pop up next.
Yeah, go ahead.
You remind me of something that bears mentioning. I don't know if people are aware of this, but I got up this morning and saw a blog post about Kucinich's speech, and up to the time, Kucinich's speech was the best speech that had been delivered.
That's true, and he was very good.
And I noted on this particular blog post over at Alternet that, you know, even Dennis had been censored because there was no mention of the I word in there. And somebody pointed out, well, you know, it's the convention. That's probably not the best place to bring up the I word. And I agree. Well, okay, so that goes away. So I'm looking around a little bit. Guess what? He really was censored.
No, that doesn't surprise me.
Because of what you just mentioned about Karl Rove, this will resonate with you. There was one line that was removed from Dennis Kucinich's speech.
Jail Karl Rove?
The original line, talking about Wake Up America, Wake Up America. He said of the Republicans, they're asking for another 4 years. In a just world, they'd get 10 to 20.
Oh, what a great line.
Yep, had to be pulled. Too mean. Too mean.
I would have left that one in. I like that. That's great. He didn't even have to use the I word. That's awesome. And you know what? He could have said it. And people, the crowd would have loved it, and the Republicans would have just said, well, that's Dennis Kucinich. They couldn't use it against the Democrats because Democrats themselves isolate themselves from Dennis Kucinich. They shouldn't have censored that. They shouldn't have censored that.
But you know what? As is usually the case with Dennis Kucinich, he was 100% correct.
Well, of course. I got to tell you, though, this is not the first nor the last speech that is censored at a Democratic National Convention.
Oh, God,
no. And Republican one as well. And what happens is the nominee gets a written text of every speech and has the right to censor it. And that actually is a very, very old tradition. And I understand it. I mean, it's his convention. It's his election. It's the candidate's face to the world. But I certainly disagree with that one. They should have let Kucinich say it.
It's a beautiful line.
Speaking of beautiful lines, though, I just, before we go, because I don't often praise John Kerry, and I really want to get this out. When he talked about all of John McCain's flip-flops, and then he concluded with the phrase that everyone thought brought Kerry down. You know, he was for it before he was against it, and then he used it against John McCain. What I liked about Kerry is he took all of the anger and all of the dirty tricks of 2004 and turned it on McCain, and I didn't know that Kerry was capable of that, and I just got to give the man the...
Oh, I've never thought he was a bad man. I think he's a downright decent man.
I think he's too.
In fact, 4 years ago this coming weekend, he was very, very kind to my young son.
Really?
Yeah.
What happened?
We were at the big, there's a huge Labor Day rally in Racine, West Virginia every year, sponsored by the United Mine Workers. We went down for it. And Ferg was trying to get up there close enough to see him. And Kerry leaned down and said, "Let that boy through." Reached down, shook Ferg's hand. It was sweet. It was incredibly sweet.
Well, that's sweet. Then again, I do think of the Don't Tase Me, Bro man, where Kerry's like, you know, you really shouldn't do that. Instead of stop that. He's a little too polite, I guess.
And speaking of which, there has been some real ugliness outside the Pepsi Center. There's video out there of, and I know they're not your favorite people, but they didn't deserve this. One of the ladies from Code Pink was literally standing there. And this cop walks up to her with a horizontal baton, busts her in the sternum with it, and knocks her onto her ass on the ground. You know, rattles her brains a little bit. So she gets up and starts talking to reporters about what happened. And before she could say much of anything, here come these black-suited cops, no badges in sight, no way of identifying them, essentially with their faces masked, and drag her off. Kind of sad.
No, that doesn't belong in America. I'll tell you. I mean, I don't know what she was doing before.
She was standing there. There's enough of a setup there that you see. There's a little golf cart, and the cops are all screaming, "Get away from the vehicle! Get away from the vehicle!" Well, she's away from the vehicle, and this cop just walks up and busts her in the chest, right in the breasts.
Hmm.
And knocks her flat on her back. And, you know, as a lawyer, the problem with that is, you know, there's no badge number. There's no way of identifying him. You don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Because what he did was he committed a criminal act.
Except that if it's in public and it's filmed, you can prosecute. I mean, you saw a video, right, Bob?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's there to be seen.
You can prosecute. People, even with the...
But how do you name this guy? Because I think you were telling this story yesterday. He needs to be sued personally so that he has to spend his money to get a lawyer.
Yeah, that's true. But though in this case, and again, I don't know all the facts, but assuming what you say, I'm not disputing you.
No. I've known you long enough. This is your nature.
Well, I am a lawyer. I'm by nature a little suspicious. Assuming the facts are as you laid them out, the right way to go about it would be to file a complaint with the police commission. And to get the name of the person, which they have to disclose, and then, go after them personally. So because you have video, now if you didn't have video, Bob, you'd be up a creek without a paddle. But with the video, I know I'm confident she can do something. I guess part of my problem, and again, I don't know what this lady did, and let's assume she did nothing, then of course it's completely awful. But I do know there's this group, the Recreate 68 group, and they announced, I heard their spokesman say, you know, "We are going to fight the police." And I remember thinking to myself, well, is that the most idiotic thing in the world? I mean, the Denver police are not Karl Rove. They're not Dick Cheney. They didn't torture anybody. I don't know who these guys are. They're probably
they have guns them. And license to use them.
Yes, but not all police are evil.
Did I say that?
No,
please don't.
But Recreate 68, in my view, is saying that. And I just think it's anarchy, and I just we have so many things that we can
fight about. But Mark, you throw that out there so easily. Oh, it's anarchy. Anarchy doesn't mean a bunch of kids running around the streets throwing water balloons with bandanas on their faces. That's not the definition of anarchy.
No, that's certainly not the definition of anarchy.
Rational anarchy is rather an elegant political stance. Because it's probably the greatest manifestation of personal responsibility out there in the political spectrum.
I just remember thinking, how stupid is this? I mean, what is the point of seeking to attack these Denver cops who have nothing to do with national policy, who are just trying to do their jobs? You know, just attack a random cop. I'm sorry. I have no sympathy for those that.
Yeah, but bear in mind, this woman was not attacking anybody.
I'm not talking about this woman.
I mean, she was a good 10 feet from the thing they were telling them to get away from.
Let me be clear. I'm not attacking the Code Pink woman. I don't know the circumstances there, and I assume they are as you say. And if so, that's vicious and police violence, and she needs to prosecute. She needs to sue. But I am talking about the spokesperson for 68, for Recreate 68, that I did see on TV. And I assume speaking for his organization, though maybe I shouldn't. Maybe he was just speaking for himself. But he was like, yeah, we're going to fight the cops harder this time. We're going to fight back. And I'm like,
you sure that guy was with Recreate 68? Because if you go and you look at their website, Mark, you'll find a very, very clear statement of nonviolent principles.
Interesting. Well, you know, that was the tagline under his name. So,
and God knows the Bush administration would never task any law enforcement agency with, you know, infiltrating.
Well, you make a good point. Hey, you make a good point. COINTELPRO, as we well know, infiltrated leftist groups and tried to make them violent so that at that time J. Edgar Hoover could spy on all of them. And I've been a firm believer for a long time, and no, I don't have proof, and I always admit it when I don't have proof. This is sheer speculation, but I think it's informed speculation. I've been believing for a long time that there's a COINTELPRO-like movement behind the 9/11 Truth Squad. I think that is planted by Bush administration.
Oh, Mark, I don't think. I'm pretty doggone certain.
Me too.
That kind of infiltration exists in virtually any contrary organization in this country. Again, it's the thing that I keep pointing to. Excuse me. But when the Bush administration actively spies on people protesting outside a Heavenly Ham store in Atlanta, you can pretty much guess that there's somebody in your organization, too.
Or they're spying on Quakers in Vermont. That's my personal favorite, I have to admit. There are Quakers.
How about the Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh? You know, peaceniks.
That's a good one, too. Yeah. Well, but Quakers, I mean, they're against all forms of violence. And these women were in their 60s. And I just don't see them joining Al-Qaeda. I just don't think it's
Yeah, but
happen.
That's okay. A woman in San Francisco got shaken down over her bra at the airport there.
Her bra?
Yeah, no
she
kidding.
Had softies in it?
No. She was a large busted woman who was going to get on her plane, and she had made the unpardonable mistake, threat to national security, news at 11, of wearing an underwire bra.
Oh, no.
So there, she walks through, the machine goes, bip, and so wand her, and they're sitting there with the wand over her breast going, bip, 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 and she said, it's the underwire, you know.
She did, yeah.
And so they said, well, we're going to have to do a naked body search of you, ma'am.
Oh, my God.
And she said, I tell you what, I'll go back.
I'll go to the bathroom,
I'll take off the bra,
right.
I'll walk back through, and you'll see. And so she did. But she was put through incredible inconvenience and humiliation. She missed her flight. She was, because she was flying from San Francisco to Boston. And so she...
Oh, you know, there's two liberal cities, Bob. She must have been a terrorist.
Oh, Jesus. I know.
San Francisco to Boston? I mean, come on. You can't... Those are the two bluest cities in the country.
Yeah, but that's, you know... and it was uncomfortable for her because, you know,
sure.
As much as hetero guys want to say, oh damn, that's pretty. Ain't that pretty? These are functional garments. and she was made to, one degree or another, suffer profound discomfort.
I don't understand this, Bob. I have a friend, a very good friend, in fact.
You do?
I do. I have friends.
Pay him well?
And it's hard to believe, I know. She was born genetically with a bad hip, and she had a hip replacement. She's a good friend of mine in her 30s. I won't say her name on air, but if you're listening, and she does listen to the show, she knows I love you. I do. Anyway, moving on. But she has a hip replacement, and it's metal, and she has a doctor's letter that she uses when she goes through the machine. I mean, there are ways. I don't know. This poor woman. I mean, people have.
Yeah, and that was mentioned in this article, Mark. Is people with hip replacements, knee replacements, people with, Lord knows, metal plates in their head.
Right, right. Medical needs. Yeah. And imagine one of them doesn't bring their doctor's thing. I mean, my poor friend has to make sure it's with her along with her passport. And then you know what's coming next. They're going to say that that's a forgery. And then I don't know what happens. I do. I feel bad for my friend. I worry about her. Whenever she goes on a plane, I worry about her.
So, you know, bless this lady's heart. She's contacting her lawyer. She's contacting the ACLU. And that's not, you know, no matter how much Bill, the falafel boy O'Reilly, complains about it, that is a legitimate function of the American Civil Liberties Union.
You know, the ACLU gets so much. I remember they called Dukakis a card-carrying member of the ACLU. Well, yeah. First of all, ACLU doesn't issue cards.
But that's back when Poppy Bush was babbling insanely about tassel loafered wearing trial lawyers.
Right, right.
Do you have tasseled loafers? Because you're not a trial lawyer unless you do.
I never have owned tassel loafers in my life. Do we want to hear Tom Hanks talk about something with regard to veterans, or should we keep talking?
We've got a call.
Oh, okay. Let's hear the caller.
Okay. Hey, welcome to the... Oh.
No, we don't.
All right, Tom Hanks.
Let's listen to Tom Hanks.
Yeah, I'm okay with Tom Hanks.
One nation. One people living in freedom. Freedom that is won and protected by these ordinary, extraordinary Americans.
Pictures of veterans, of course, and the audience cheering and talking. And then we go.
Yeah, I think we're a little slow on the uptake, Mark.
No comment.
Please welcome to the podium Iraq War veteran Major Tammy Duckworth.
Well, let's see what let's see what she's got to say, because if anybody can criticize John McCain,
4 years ago,
she can.
I was co-piloting a Black Hawk helicopter north of Baghdad when a rocket propelled grenade struck the cockpit. My buddies carried me out, not knowing if I was dead or alive. They knew the soldier's creed, never leave a fallen comrade behind. They lived up to it, risked their lives to save mine. Because of them, I am here today, Iraq War veteran, female helicopter pilot, and wounded warrior. Because of them, I am here today, Asian American, a daughter of the American Revolution, a daughter of an immigrant. Acts of courage like theirs happen everywhere American troops serve. They're happening right now, and I know that. My father served in Vietnam. My brother served in the Coast Guard. And my husband just returned from Operation Iraqi Freedom. We serve because we believe in this great nation, and because our service members support us, we must always keep the faith with them. The administration of George Bush, supported by John McCain every step of the way, has let our warriors down. Our troops are courageous, strong, fierce. This administration has redeployed them until they are overstretched, stressed, and strained. Our warriors should fight in Afghanistan to defeat Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. But instead of destroying the enemies who attacked us on 9/11, we diverted our military might to Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. When our warriors come home, they deserve the best VA medical care. But too often, they get bureaucracy, not benefits. They find inadequate access, inferior facilities, and infuriating paperwork. Now, John McCain wants to ration care. He'd keep the VA for combat injuries, but everyone else gets an insurance card. Barack Obama has a different idea. Barack Obama will live up to their tradition of honor and sacrifice. Barack Obama understands that for a commander-in-chief to support the military, he needs a little bit more than a mission accomplished banner. More than a borrowed flight suit, and definitely more than 4 more years of the same failed foreign policy. President Obama will restore the might of the military. He will invest in our troops and only send our sons and daughters to war if they have a defined mission and the tools they need. I speak from more than a gut feeling on this. I know because I know Barack Obama. He visited me and other wounded troops at Walter Reed. He came without reporters. He wasn't looking for credit. He just cared about how we were doing. He knew that wherever you stand on the war, you must love the warrior, and he does. I testified before his committee. I listened to him talk. I watched what he did and how he voted. Barack Obama fought to improve the lives of all veterans. He fought to fix our rundown hospitals, fought to cut through the red tape. And unlike John McCain, Barack Obama fought for a new GI Bill and won. So that every veteran has the same opportunity to pursue their American dream, just like Barack's grandfather did after World War II. So I know what he'll do as president. And America, with President Obama, will have a 21st century VA. He'll improve access to health care. He'll speed up disability claims. He'll increase services for post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries, as we have already done in Illinois under Governor Blagojevich's leadership. Barack Obama will have a simple principle for homeless veterans: zero tolerance, because we are all dishonored when those who have worn the uniform sleep on our streets. But here's what he won't do. President Obama will reject John McCain's plan to privatize the VA. We won't force veterans to search for medical care with nothing but a plastic card and a promise. We won't have means testing for access to the VA. Because Barack Obama knows this. When we enlisted, no one asked us where we lived or how much money we had. And no one should ask us that after we've bled for our country. Fellow Democrats, fellow Americans, I love this nation more than my own life. Today, we can honor our military men and women by living up to that soldier's creed. just like I know Bo Biden will when he's deployed next month with the Delaware Army National Guard. Today, we can give our veterans the benefits they rightfully earned. Today, we can change our relations with the world. I believe that America will elect the leader who has always fought to keep our nation's promise, the leader who can best keep this nation strong. Barack Obama is right for the military. Barack Obama is right for our veterans. Barack Obama is right for our country, and that's why Barack Obama will be our next Commander-in-Chief. God bless you, and always God bless America.
Well, that was pretty good.
Yeah, that was pretty good, and she's a very respectable woman.
And here she walks off. She has no legs, of course. She has metal prosthesis. I wonder if she has trouble going through metal detectors. Bob, tell the story about the cut and run.
Yeah, well, her opponent, Peter Roskam, a right-wing Republican, in regard to her remarks about...
I'm sorry, Bob, not to interrupt you. They're about to nominate a Joe Biden for vice president.
Oh, well, we need to cut to that then, please.
It's Quincy Lucas. My sister Whitney was my best friend. Sadly, in 2003, she was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. Violence against women often happens in the shadows, out of public view. Since that time, I've devoted my life to bringing it into the light. But I realize that sometimes to change lives, you have to change the law. Joe Biden understands. In 1994, he wrote the Violence Against Women Act so every woman would have a place to turn for support. He's constantly making sure it has the funding it needs. And today, countless women get a second chance at life because of Joe Biden. So, in memory of my sister, and in the name of women of all across this country, I am proud to place into nomination the name of Joe Biden to be our next vice president! Yeah! Yeah!
Here come the Biden signs.
Thank you.
God, this guy's this convention really well organized. I didn't even see him hand out those things. I assume Biden's next. I mean, I don't know. Maybe
please welcome permanent chair of the 2008 convention, Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Now, we're going to nominate him a bunch.
I guess so. Let's hear what Nancy has to say.
Do we got to?
Yes, we do, Bob.
The name of Joe Biden of Delaware has been placed in nomination as the Democratic Party's vice presidential candidate. Is there a second? The chair will entertain a motion to suspend the rules and to nominate by acclamation Joe Biden as the Democratic Party's vice presidential candidate. Oh. Is there a second? All those in favor to suspend the rules and nominate Joe Biden by acclamation, please say aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it. Joe Biden has been selected by nomination to be the Democratic nominee for the United States of America.
Not a single no in the room. I kind of thought somebody might say no.
Well, you know what? If I'd been there, because I'm a smartass.
C-11 of the convention's rules of procedure.
Fade this, because this is too good.
Senator Biden has been invited to make an acceptance speech.
He'll be on. But you'll notice that nobody said it's on off the table.
I assume he's coming up now.
My dad used to have an expression.
Video.
You don't measure success on whether or not you've been knocked down. It's how quickly you get back up. Because everybody gets knocked down. The measure is getting back up. That's the story of this country. It has never failed to get back up.
Joe is salt of the earth. He's somebody who, you know, hasn't forgotten the people in those communities where he grew up.
People in my neighborhood don't like the phrase working class. The guys I grew up with, their mothers mostly didn't work back in those days, and their fathers didn't go to college, but they were proud. And if you asked them what they were middle class.
My dad tells it like it is. From the time he was a kid in Scranton, who people made fun of because he stuttered, to a young man who gets elected to the United States Senate when he was 29 years old, starts a campaign no one thought they could win.
The thing that I'm proudest of is the fact that the people in the state of Delaware have elected me 6 times in a row because I think they believe I haven't lost their voice.
My dad experienced great triumph along with my family, but also great tragedy. Losing my mom and my sister in an automobile accident, and my brother and I survived. What my dad did then was he came to my bedside and my brother's, and he's never left it.
When Joe was just elected, he made the commitment to take the train every single day to be home with the children. And no matter where he is or what he's doing, if one of the children calls, he stops and takes the call.
I had 4 children. I lost one, but I have 3 lovely children. They're each other's best friends.
He's a wonderful father. He's an exceptional grandfather. And that's really what it's about for him.
There are very few people who have the depth of experience of Joe Biden, not only as the head of the Judiciary Committee, as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but he's also been at the forefront on critical legislation.
The things I'm most proud of in my career are writing and passing the Violence Against Women Act. We brought down violent crime with the crime bill that I drafted.
Joe has unequaled foreign policy credentials. He's consulted with presidents, has personal relationships with many world leaders. He's somebody who, on the Iraq War, was willing to speak out, and when he saw that the Bush administration wasn't using that authority properly.
When you see the abuse of power, you've got to speak. Whether it's a parent slapping around a child, or a president taking a nation to war that cost lives that was not a necessary war, that's abuse of power.
Joe is truly a leader, and I think he has such strength of character. I think people know that they can believe in him. They know that he wants change, and I think they know that the country will change with Barack Obama and Joe Biden.
The most important thing that Joe offers is his honesty, and I can't imagine a more effective advocate in the vice presidency to bring about the changes that we need here in America.
The middle class in this country has never been as unsure of their future, and we've never been as isolated. And if we don't change that in the next 4 years, we're locked in for a decade. And Barack Obama has been very explicit about how he's going to level the playing field for the firemen and the cops and the linemen and the salespersons and the nurses to improve their circumstance so their next generation is better off than they were. I think Barack and I will work as a team great. I can hardly wait to help him turn this country around.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Delaware Attorney General, Captain Beau Biden.
Good evening. I'm Beau Biden, and Joe Biden is my dad. Many of you know him as a distinguished and accomplished senator. I know him as an incredible father and a loving grandfather, a man who hustled home to Delaware after the last vote so he wouldn't miss me and my brother's games, who after returning from some war-torn region of the world would tiptoe literally into our rooms and kiss us goodnight, who turns down some fancy cocktail party in Washington so he won't miss my daughter Natalie's birthday. The truth is, he almost wasn't a senator at all. In 1972, shortly after his improbable victory, but before he took the oath of office, my father went to Washington to look at his new office space. My mom took us to go buy a Christmas tree. On the way home, we were in an automobile accident. My mom, Nelia, and my sister, Naomi, were killed. My brother, Hunter, and I were seriously injured and hospitalized for weeks. I was just short of 4 years old. One of my earliest memories was being in that hospital, my dad always at our side. We, my brother and I, not the Senate, were all that he cared about. He decided not to take the oath of office. He said then, Delaware can get another senator, but my boys can't get another father. However, great men like Ted Kennedy, Mike Mansfield, Hubert Humphrey, men who have been tested in their own right, convinced him to serve. He was sworn in the hospital at my bedside. As a single parent, he decided to be there, to put us to bed, to be there when we woke up from a bad dream, to make us breakfast. So he traveled to and from Washington 4 hours a day. 5 years later, we, my brother, dad, and I, married my mom, Jill. And they together rebuilt our family. And 36 years later, he still makes that trip. So even though Dad worked in Washington, he's never been part of Washington. He always sounded like the kid from Scranton, Pennsylvania that he is. And even that is a story of overcoming. Now, some people poke fun at my dad talking too much. What a lot of people don't know, though, is that when he was a young boy, he had a severe stutter. The kids called him Dash, not because he was fast in the football field, which he was, but like a dash at the end of a sentence you can't finish. But now he speaks with a clear and strong voice. He says what needs to be said, and he does what needs to be done. When domestic violence was often a dark secret, Dad wrote the Violence Against Women Act, which gave countless women the protection and support and protection and a new chance at life. When crime was spiking in our communities, Dad wrote the crime bill that put 100,000 cops on our streets and led to an 8-year drop in the crime across America. And when Serbian thugs were committing genocide in the Balkans, Dad didn't hesitate to call Slobodan Milosevic a war criminal to his face, and to convince Congress and our allies to act. He's willing to speak truth to power, to the White House, and to world leaders. I know my father will be a great vice president. As I mentioned, my dad has always been there for me, my brother, my sister, every day. But because of other duties, it won't be possible for me to be here this fall, to stand by him the way he stood by me. So I have something to ask of you. Be there for my dad, like he was for me. Be there for Barack Obama, because our country needs him. Be there for both of them, because millions of families need to know that their best days aren't behind them, but are ahead of them. Be there for both of them, because millions of people are trying to overcome, just like my dad overcame. Be there. Be there because Barack Obama and Joe Biden will deliver America the change we so desperately need. Please join me in welcoming my friend, my father, my hero, the next Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Bye.
Joe Biden greeted his son, now standing in front of the crowd. Lots of red signs showing Biden an American flag.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And thank you, John Kerry. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. You know, folks, my dad used to have an expression. He'd say, a father knows he's a success when he turns and looks at his son or daughter and know that they turned out better than he did. I'm a success. I'm a hell of a success. Bowie, I love you. I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of the son you become. I'm so proud of the father you are. And I'm also so proud of my son Hunter and my daughter Ashley. And my wife, Jill, the only one who leaves me both breathless and speechless at the same time. It's an honor to share this stage tonight with President Clinton, a man who I think brought this country so far along that I only pray we do it again. And last night it was moving to watch Hillary, one of our great leaders, a great leader of this party, a woman who has made history and will continue to make history. A colleague, my friend, Senator Hillary Clinton. And I am truly honored to live in a country with the bravest warriors in the world. And I'm honored to represent the first state, my state, the state of Delaware. Since I've never been called a man of few words, let me say it as simply as I can. Yes, yes, I accept your nomination to run and serve with Barack Obama, the next President of the United States of America. And let me make this pledge to you right here and now. For every American who is trying to do the right thing, for all those people in government who are honoring the pledge to uphold the law and honor the Constitution, no longer will you hear the 8 most dreaded language words in the English language. The Vice President's office is on the phone. Barack and I took very different journeys to this destination. But we share a common story. Mine began in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and then Wilmington, Delaware. My dad, who fell on hard times, always told me, though, champ, when you get knocked down, get up. Get up. I was taught that by my dad. And God, I wish my dad was here tonight. But I thank God and I'm grateful that my mom, Catherine Eugenia Finnegan Biden, is here tonight. Mom, I love you. You know, my mom taught her children
all the children who flock to our house that you're defined by your sense of honor and you're redeemed by your loyalty. She believes that bravery lives in every heart, and her expectation is that it will be summoned. Failure. Failure at some point in your life is inevitable, but giving up is unforgivable. As a child, I stuttered, and she lovingly would look at me and tell me, "Joey, it's because you're so bright you can't get the thoughts out quickly enough." When I was not as well dressed as the other kids, she'd look at me and say, "Joey, oh, you're so handsome, honey, you're so handsome." And when I got knocked down by guys bigger than me, and this is the God's truth, she sent me back out and said, "Bloody their nose so you can walk down the street the next day." And that's what I did. You know, and after the accident, she told me, she said, "Joey, God sends no cross that you cannot bear." And when I triumphed, my mother was quick to remind me it was because of others. My mother's creed is the American creed. No one is better than you. Everyone is your equal, and everyone is equal to you. My parents taught us to live our faith and to treasure our family. We learned the dignity of work, and we were told that anyone can make it if they just try hard enough. That was America's promise. And for those of us who grew up in middle-class neighborhoods like Scranton and Wilmington, that was the American dream. Ladies and gentlemen, but today, that American dream feels like it's slowly slipping away. I don't have to tell you that. You feel it every single day in your own lives. I've never seen a time when Washington has watched so many people get knocked down without doing anything to help them get back up. Almost every single night, I take the train home to Wilmington, Delaware, sometimes very late. As I sit there in my seat and I look out that window, and I see those flickering lights of the homes that pass by, I can almost hear the conversation they're having at their kitchen table after they put their kids to bed. Like millions of Americans, they're asking questions as ordinary as they are profound. Questions they never, ever thought they'd have to ask themselves. Should Mom move into this now that Dad's gone? $50, $60, $70 just to fill up the gas tank. How in God's name with winter coming? How are we going to heat the home? Another year, no raise. Did you hear they may be cutting our health care at the company? Now we owe more money on our home than our home is worth. How in God's name are we going to send the kids to college? How are we going to retire, Joe? You know, folks, that's the America that George Bush has left us. And that's the America we'll continue to get if John McCain is elected president of the United States of America. Freudian slip. Freudian slip. And folks, these are not isolated discussions among families down in their luck. These are common stories among middle-class people who worked hard their whole life, played by the rules, on the promise that their tomorrows would be better than their yesterdays. That promise is the promise of America. It defines who we are as a people. And now it's in jeopardy. I know it. You know it. But John McCain doesn't seem to get it. Barack Obama gets it, though. Like many of us in this room, like many of us in this hall, Barack Obama has worked his way up. He is the great American story. You know, I believe the measure of a man is not the road he travels, but the choices he makes along that road. And ladies and gentlemen, Barack Obama could have done anything after he graduated from college. With all his talent and promise, he could have written his own ticket to Wall Street. But what did he choose to do? He chose to go to Chicago, the South Side of Chicago. There in the South Side, he met women and men who had lost their jobs. Their neighborhood was devastated when the local steel plant closed. Their dreams had to be deferred. Their self-esteem was gone. And ladies and gentlemen, he made their lives the work of his life. That's what you do when you're raised by a single mom who worked, went to school, and raised two kids on her own. That's how you come to believe to the very core of your being that work is more than a paycheck. It's dignity. It's respect. It's about whether or not you can look your child in the eye and say, we're going to be all right. Because Barack Obama made that choice, 150 more children and parents have health care in Illinois. He fought to make that happen. And because Barack Obama made that choice, working families in Illinois pay less taxes and more people have moved from welfare to the dignity of work. And he got it done. And when he came to Washington, John and I watched with amazement how he hit the ground running, leading the fight to pass the most sweeping ethics reform in a generation. He reached across party lines to pass a law that helped keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of terrorists. And then he moved Congress and the President to give our wonderful wounded warriors the care and dignity they deserve. You know, you can learn a lot about a man, campaigning with him, debating him, seeing how he reacts under pressure. You learn about the strength of his mind, but even more importantly, you learn about the quality of his heart. I watched how Barack touched people, how he inspired them, and I realized he had tapped into the oldest belief in America. We don't have to accept the situation we cannot bear. We have the power to change it. And change it is exactly what Barack Obama will do. That's what he'll do for this country. You know, John McCain is my friend, and I know you hear that phrase used all the time in politics. I mean it. John McCain is my friend. We've traveled the world together. It's a friendship that goes beyond politics. And the personal courage and heroism demonstrated by John still amazes me. But I profoundly disagree with the direction John wants to take this country, from Afghanistan to Iraq, from Amtrak to veterans. You know, John thinks that during the Bush years, quote, we've made great economic progress. I think it's been abysmal. And in the Senate, John has voted with President Bush 95%, and that is very hard to believe. And when John McCain proposes $200 million in new taxes for corporate America, $1 billion alone for the largest companies in the nation, but no relief
Well, of all the rotten times to have that happen, I'm sure that Mark will have that back in just a moment. For all we know, Stephanie Miller stepped on his internet connection again. Or kicked it. Oh, you there, Mark? Am I in your headphones, Mark? I guess... reconnect real quick, please, Mark. Okay, we'll have the feedback in a matter of seconds. What a speech so far. What a humdinger of a speech. Okay, let's see.
These times
there we go. Thanks, Mark Levine.
They require a wise leader. A leader who can change. Change the change that everybody knows we need. Barack Obama is going to deliver that change. Because I want to tell you, Barack Obama will reform our tax code. He will cut taxes for 95% of the American people who draw a paycheck. That's the change we need. Barack Obama will transform the economy by making alternative energy a national priority and in the process creating 5 million new jobs and finally, freeing us from the grip of foreign oil. That's the change we need. Barack Obama knows that any country that out-teaches us today will out-compete us tomorrow. That's why he'll invest in the next generation of teachers and why he'll make college more affordable. That's the change we need. Barack Obama will bring down health care costs by $2,500 for the average family and at long last deliver affordable, accessible health care for every American. That's the change we need. Barack will put more cops on the street, put security back in Social Security, and he'll never, ever, ever give up until we achieve equal pay for women. That's the change we need. And as we gather here tonight, our country is less secure and more isolated than it has been any time in recent history. The Bush foreign policy has dug us into a very deep hole with very few friends to help us climb out. And for the last 7 years, the administration has failed to face the biggest forces shaping this century. The emergence of Russia, China, and India's great powers, the spread of lethal weapons, the shortage of secure supplies of energy, food, and water, the challenge of climate change, and the resurgence of fundamentalism in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the real central front in the war on terror. Ladies and gentlemen, recent years and in recent days, we've once again seen the consequences of the neglect, of this neglect, with Russia challenging the very freedom of a new democratic country of Georgia. Barack and I will end that neglect. We will hold Russia accountable for its actions, and we will help the people of Georgia rebuild. I've been on the ground in Georgia, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and I can tell you in no uncertain terms, this administration's policy has been an abysmal failure. America cannot afford 4 more years of this failure. And now, despite being complicit in this catastrophic foreign policy, John McCain says Barack Obama is not ready to protect our national security. Now let me ask you this. Whose judgment do you trust? Should you trust the judgment of John McCain when he said only 3 years ago, Afghanistan, we don't read about it anymore in the papers because it succeeded? Or should you believe Barack Obama, who said a year ago, we need to send 2 more combat battalions to Afghanistan? The fact of the matter is, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, the people who actually attacked us on 9/11, they've regrouped in the mountains between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they are plotting new attacks. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has echoed Barack's call for more troops. John McCain was wrong, and Barack Obama was right. Should we trust John McCain's judgment? When he rejected talking with Iran and then asked, what is there to talk about?
Or Barack Obama, who said, we must talk and make clear to Iran that it must change. Now, after 7 years of denial, even the Bush administration recognizes that we should talk to Iran because that's the best way to ensure our security. Again and again, John McCain has been wrong and Barack Obama is right. Should we trust John McCain's judgment when he says we can't have no timelines to draw down our troops from Iraq, that we must stay indefinitely? Or should we listen to Barack Obama, who says shift the responsibility to the Iraqis and set a time to bring our combat troops home? Now, after 6 long years, the administration and the Iraqi government are on the verge of setting a date to bring our troops home. John McCain was wrong, and Barack Obama was right. Again, and again, on the most important national security issues of our time, John McCain was wrong, and Barack Obama has been proven right. Folks, remember when the world used to trust us, when they looked to us for leadership? With Barack Obama as our president, they'll look at us again, they'll trust us again, and we'll be able to lead again. Folks, Jill and I are truly honored to join Michelle and Barack on this journey. When I look at their young children, when I look at my grandchildren, I know why I'm here. I'm here for their future. I'm here for everyone I grew up with in Scranton and Wilmington. I'm here for the cops and the firefighters, the teachers and the assembly line workers, the folks whose lives are the very measure of whether the American dream endures. Our greatest presidents, from Abraham Lincoln to Franklin Roosevelt to John Kennedy, they all challenged us to embrace change. Now it is our responsibility to meet that challenge. Millions of Americans have been knocked down, and this is the time, as Americans together, we get back up together. Our debt to our parents and our grandparents is too great. Our obligation to our children is too sacred. These are extraordinary times. This is an extraordinary election. The American people are ready. I am ready. Barack is ready. This is his time. This is our time. This is America's time. God bless America, and may God protect our troops. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I always kind of like the swan song at the end of these things. I always kind of like it. Oh, wait, here comes his wife. Yeah, that's sweet.
You know, I think, Mark, I think the choice of Joe Biden has defanged the Republicans in many ways.
And honey, tonight we have a very special surprise guest.
A surprise guest?
Brain
we don't
baby?
Know. I don't know.
Who?
He doesn't know either. He really doesn't. Barack Obama! Wow. And he looks genuinely surprised. I think we all are. Congratulating him, telling him what a good speech he did. He's not speaking, of course. He's just waving. There you go. There's Joe Biden and Barack Obama and Jill. Joe Biden. Joe Biden's wife in the middle. Hands up in the air. You know that's going to be in the papers tomorrow. Now she's walked off, and here's the shot, the money shot. You know, all you're going to see, there it is. Barack Obama, Joe Biden, arm in arm, hands up. Oh, here's Barack Obama.
Hello, Democrats! I just wanted to come out here for a little something to say. I want everybody to now understand why I am so proud to have Joe Biden and Bo Biden and Mama Biden and the whole Biden family with me on this journey to take America back. I think the convention's gone pretty well so far. What do you think? I think Michelle Obama kicked it off pretty well, don't you think? If I'm not mistaken, Hillary Clinton rocked the house last night. In case you were wondering, I think President Bill Clinton reminded us of what it's like when you've got a president who actually puts people first. Thank you, President Clinton. We are going to be moving to Mile High Stadium tomorrow. And I want to let you know why. At the start of this campaign, we had a very simple idea, which is change in America doesn't start from the top up, top down, it starts from the bottom up. That the change is brought about because ordinary people do extraordinary things. And so we want to open up this convention to make sure that everybody who wants to come can join in the party and join in the effort to take America back. I think we are going to have a great night tomorrow night, and I look forward to seeing you there. God bless you. God bless America.
Barack Obama's going down the line, greeting all of the people on the stage. Joe Biden is too now. Well, that was a nice surprise. Oh, wait, who's coming out now? Family members, of course. Mom and sisters and grandkids and all the Biden family. Oh, I gotta say, that's a good looking family. I love his mother. She just looks like the sweetest woman in the world. Now, lots of people are coming out. I don't know who some of these people are. Aunts, uncles, cousins, who knows? Got a big smile. You know, Barack Obama, he is a happy warrior. One thing about Kerry 4 years ago, he seemed always so sullen. And Obama seems like, yeah, there's something nice about just a big smile.
Oh, what a great song.
Talk about family values, Bob.
Oh, I know.
I think he's huge.
For the most part, with very few exceptions, Mark, this evening, and most of the convention thus far has been pitch perfect.
It really has. I love that cute little boy. I don't know if that's a grandchild or what. Looks like he's about 4 or 5. Holding his hand with Joe Biden.
No, that's grandson.
Yeah. Yeah, and Catholic families, they are large.
And
they're really good looking.
No, I can't hear that song without thinking about the 1979 Pittsburgh Pirates.
Oh, you're not going to do a sports metaphor, are you?
Well, no. I mean, that just made that song. And you know what? In Western Pennsylvania, which is very, very important to Barack Obama, that means something.
He's going to win Pennsylvania. I have no doubt he's going to win Pennsylvania.
No, he is up. He's up by a few points there, but no.
He'll win it.
Everything is a matter of perception, and it's you know how it is, Mark. I mean, you hear that old song that you loved years ago, and it makes you time travel. Look what Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow did for you just a little bit ago.
Oh, it totally did. That always makes you think of Bill Clinton.
So,
they're such men of the people, I got to say. Look at Joe Biden. He's like telling some personal story to some guys leaning over. I mean, he's just supposed to be waving at the crowd, and he's like,
Joe Biden. These are regular people.
Yeah, and he's a regular guy.
Between Barack Obama and Joe Biden, you've got the two nearest to the
ordinary Joes, if you will.
Well, yeah, but the two nearest things to the literally to the born in a log cabin story that we've had in a long, long time, with the exception of Bill Clinton.
Right, but I was just gonna say Bill Clinton was the exception. You're absolutely right.
I'm feeling kind of good about this, and I got to say, the more I listen, I love the tenor and timbre of Barack Obama's voice, because by virtue of what we do here and what I do here, I tune into that, and when it comes debate time, and it may very well be a Nixon versus Kennedy kind of moment, because one, they're going to have to deal with John McCain's, shall we say, lack of stature, physical, because he's 5'7".
Right, right. And Barack's
in heels. And Barack is what, 6'2", 6'3", 6'4"?
No, he's not 6'4". 6'2", maybe in a bit.
And that's going to create a real dichotomy unless the for-profit media figures out a way to put McCain on a box.
Well, you know, they had that big fight between Dukakis and George H.W. Bush. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes.
Because Dukakis wanted, but Bush insisted that the podiums be the same size, which, of course, would make, and Dukakis insisted on proportionate podiums.
So, yeah.
Right. I don't see Obama playing those games, but, you know, hey.
But beyond that, you're going to have, because Obama's voice is rich and, dare I say it, sonorous.
Solid. He's a solid guy. And,
I know this is like the esoterics and stuff, but you know, the X factor matters. And when you compare that beautiful voice of Barack Obama with the sort of pathetic, weaselly, nasally, my friends, of John McCain, oh, dear God.
It's more than that. It's like I said, he has a nice smile. And I don't mean you know, attractive. Like, you know, what I mean is he's a happy guy.
Yeah.
That also reminds me of John Kennedy. You know, we've been through hell. We've been through 8 years of, you know, the worst 8 years in American history since, I don't know, World War II, Civil War, the Great Depression. I mean, you have to think of some really extreme times. And unlike, oh, some of those, it was entirely this administration's fault. I mean, you know, Roosevelt couldn't help the Nazis. Okay, the Depression, I will blame that on Hoover. You know, the Civil War, the point is that this administration has done so much bad to us from the very moment they stole the election of 2000 and came into power that so many Americans, so many liberals, let's face it, so many Democrats are depressed. We're depressed and we're angry and we're ready for revenge. And,
But
Obama takes us out of that.
Yeah, if you go from 2000 to 2004, in 2000 we felt a hell of a lot like burglary victims. I don't know if you've ever had this happen to you, but if you walk into your home and you find out that it's been burgled,
yeah,
there's a sense of sort of spiritual violence, if you will.
Right.
And a sense of violation.
Right.
Because that's, you know, exactly. That is literally your castle. That is your sacred space. And the ripoff of 2000 left, and I would hazard to say you felt the same way. You feel
yeah,
like
it moved me to Washington.
Yeah, you feel like a crime victim.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of baggage that goes with that. But then you get to 2004, and after 2004, yeah, depression is the very real word to use for it.
Well, you know, you go through the five stages, right? When the Supreme Court decision came down, my first thought was denial. This isn't happening. This isn't America. This isn't my country. I mean, that happens in Mexico. That happens in Chile. That happens in dictatorships around the globe. There's coups but my country? I mean, America is not perfect, God knows. But they're going to steal an election? And yeah, so first comes denial, right? Then comes rage. And oh boy, was I raging. Then came bargaining. I was sending missives to the Gore campaign, begging them to challenge it, begging them to go farther. And by the time we reached John Kerry in 2004, there was, depression. And I think John Kerry reflected that depression. He wasn't a happy warrior. He was an angry one, and he had every right to be. But Obama is saying to me, you know what? You can't change the past. It's awful. But you can't change the past. You can change the future. And there's something very uplifting just looking at the man. Just he's kind of easygoing, in a sense. You know, he's got a warm smile. But unlike, you know, the empty, warm smile of Reagan, you feel he's got the intellect behind it to actually do something about it. You feel, dare I say, comfortable that maybe, just maybe, we're in good hands again.
For a matter of seconds, you know, I met the man a couple of years ago. And, you know, he came, he was walking backstage at the JJ dinner where we were doing the audio. And just, you know, he walked by and just said, hey, how you doing? And, hey, man, yeah, and shook my hand. And, you know, not with that stuffed shirt, you know, still got the wire hanger in the back of it, politician. Well, hello, my friend. Yeah, none of that. And that much was impressive. And that was back when he was still finding his voice, Mark. Because I got to tell you, much like Bill Clinton delivered a disastrous address to the 1988 Democratic National Convention, you know, the one where the audience applauded when Bill said, in closing.
I do remember that.
Barack Obama's address in Charleston was dreadful.
Really?
Oh.
When was this, Bob? What year? Do you remember?
Let's see. It was two autumns ago, so it would be...
06.
Yeah. It was because it was prior to the midterm elections of 06.
Yeah.
And he had come there. He had come there, Mark, at the behest of Robert Byrd.
No wonder he's feeling a little uneasy.
Well, no, that was a calculated move. For a variety of reasons that probably don't bear going into. But it's also where he began polishing the story of his family.
You know what, Bob? I'm going to do you one better. Sorry about this.
No, not you.
Not to one-up you, but my cousin, my second cousin, who was born in Chicago, lived there his entire life, attends the same gym as Barack Obama and has, yes, played basketball with Barack Obama.
Oh, now stop it.
I'll give you his name. You know what? I'll tell you what. At some point, maybe in a couple weeks, I'll bring him on the air.
At the risk of seeming stereotypical, you're not gonna tell me about a Jewish basketball player, are you?
My cousin Stuart's pretty good.
All right, you know, stranger things have happened, Mark.
A lot better than I am. He's actually a pretty good athlete. In any case, he's not a friend of Barack Obama. I'm not going to exaggerate. He's an acquaintance of Barack Obama. You know, Obama knows his name. It's not much more than that. But he's played basketball with the guy.
And
he's just a good guy. He's a nice guy. He's a friendly guy. He's a warm guy. He's not at all stuffy. He's just, you know, he plays a good basketball game. And George Bush plays a guy's guy, right? He plays it as an act. He buys a ranch that his family never owned.
Yeah, right, like Reagan played cowboy.
Right.
But that's what Republicans do.
But Obama is just a natural guy. He's just a guy. He plays basketball. I loved it. One of my most memorable lines so far that I'm going to really remember, and I'm going to ask Stuart about this. I'll do it on the air. I'll bring him on the horn in a couple weeks. But the line that Michelle Obama said about her brother told her, "You want to know the measure of a man? Play sports with him." And she said, and I don't have the direct quote here, but something to the effect of, "He's a guy who wasn't intimidated, took the shot when he could, but when he couldn't, passed it off to his teammates." In other words, the job was to get the job done. It wasn't about him being the star. And we all, you know, those of us that follow basketball, and believe it or not, I do on occasion, know all about the players that just want to be the star. And never.
No, I'm a college hoops guy. I don't care much for the NBA, but I'm a college hoops guy.
Either way, we all know that the college player or the NBA player that thinks he's good, and he probably is good, but he's being blocked, and he takes the shot anyway because he's the hero. But Obama's not that kind of guy. He knows when to take the shot. He doesn't back down, but sometimes he passes it to his teammates because he just wants to get the job done. And it's just amazing to me, this sort of easy, natural, we all know these sort of winning guys, charming people. They've got that natural personality, not this forced, I'm gonna clear brush. George, you've paid Mexicans to clear brush for the last 50 years. They were illegal immigrants to boot.
Which reminds me, Mark, I have a sneaking suspicion we're going to find out about John McCain's undocumented alien hiring habits pretty soon. I've just got a suspicion. Let's go to the phones real quick, Mark. I know you've got to break down and get out of there pretty soon.
No. I can hang a little bit. I haven't got much sleep already. Well, what's another, you know, hour less?
Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Katie.
Hey, Katie, how are you?
Good, how are
you? Hello, Katie.
I just wanted
What'd you think, Katie?
Huh?
What'd you think of the speech?
I'm sorry? What I think of the speech? I thought it was great. I thought it was fantastic. I had never heard him speak before.
You never heard Joe Biden before?
No. I read more stuff.
I tell you, he was better than he usually is. He usually gets a little bit long-winded. And don't get me wrong, I love Joe Biden, but I do it too, actually. So I guess that's why I have affection for him. You know, you make your point, and then you make it again, and then you make it one more time to be sure. I do that sometimes. Joe Biden does that a lot.
Well, what I wanted to say about Obama that you guys were describing is, and I don't mean this in a trite way or anything, he's cool.
Yeah, hey, he is, cool. Isn't he?
That's exactly the word. You named it. Katie, you got it. He's cool.
And that's all I really wanted to say is it's nice to have a cool candidate.
It's nice to have a cool president. The last cool president we had was John Kennedy. Well, yeah. You know, I kind of thought Clinton was cool when he was on he had the saxophone on the Arsenio show, and I thought that was cool. So yeah, Clinton's kind of cool.
Well, Katie, and interestingly, you making that comment is reminiscent of something I just saw in the chat room. I don't know if it's still there or not, but Fancy in the chat room a few minutes ago said, "Yeah, next week in Minneapolis, John McCain will treat us to some of the hot happening hits from the Glenn Miller Orchestra."
It'll be country music. Oh, did I say that? I'm sorry.
No, it will be. It'll be and it'll be bad country music. Let's make no doubt. Yeah.
But Bob, I mean, isn't Glenn Miller the latest act?
Here's the line. The Repubs will be wowing them with Wilford Brimley and the great Glenn Miller cover band. not even Glenn Miller cover band.
Wilford Brimley.
No,
I think
Scrubs cover band. Sorry.
Oh.
You know, I don't know if either of you saw this wonderful Jon Stewart. It was classic. It was when Obama was in Europe. And so he shows Obama and his head's on, you know, a knight fighting dragons and all, you know, cartoons as he's slaying them and so forth. And then he shows John McCain. He's got a tear in his eye. And he's in that little chair electric chair that goes up the staircase when someone's too old to walk up the staircase themselves. I was just classic.
We've got one of the quickest, sharpest audiences on planet Earth. This just in from News Ninja Gene: Obama cool, McCain drool.
There you go.
Campaign slogan for 2008.
Hey, Katie, good to hear from you. We hear from you far too little.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Talk to you later.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Katie, for putting in one word what I was trying to say in 103.
Well, thanks, yeah, I mean, and that yeah, we're Lord knows you're guilty of it. I'm guilty of it, and you get something, you know, exponential and hard to calculate mathematically when we're sort of going at it at the same time. And that, you know, we're a classic case of, you know, somebody asks either one of us what time it is, we tell them how to build a clock.
Well, it's important to build clocks, Bob.
God, I love it. And by the way, in the meantime, I've gotten straightened up, Mark.
Really? Because I'm a mess. I got wires all over the place.
No, that's not what I mean. I got wised up. You know, every now and then I open my mouth and bats fly out. Bob, get a grip. Please remember the NBA was founded in the 40s on Jewish players. They were the inner city outsiders in the 40s.
I guess that's true.
That's our buddy David in Tennessee, knower of many, many things.
I wonder if David's a fellow Jewish Tennessean. You know, there are not many of us.
Look, you know, when you get right down to it, we're all some of something or another. You know, Agnes has like, you know, 1/32nd or 1/64th Jewish in her.
Yeah, and she's told me about it several times.
She's very proud of it.
Yes, she is, and I'm proud that she's proud of it.
And you know what?
By the way, I don't know if I say this publicly enough. I say it behind the scenes all the time. I don't often say it on air. But, Bob, you got the greatest wife in the world. You know, I look at these candidates. I look at their wives. Yeah, Michelle Obama's cool. She's great. She's wonderful. Jill Biden, wonderful lady. Bob, you got the best wife in the world. I want to say it publicly because I told you privately. I want to say it before the entire world.
I know I do, and I will not sit here and say that she has the best husband because she doesn't. But you know, she's.
Well, I didn't say that.
No, she's. No, nor did I expect you to. But you know, school just started here, and so Margie started her first year of high school, which means she has to get on the bus at 6 a.m.
Aww.
To get to school by 7:30, a school that's 6 miles up the road. So the hateful, what we refer to as the hateful alarm, goes off at 5:30. So Agnes stays up to make sure that I'm okay. And that I'm, you know, she keeps me in sweet tea and stuff like that to get me through the evening. And then she's bouncing out of the bed at 5:30. Remember the tagline to the old Geritol commercial? My wife, I think I'll keep her. No, it's my wife, I hope she keeps me.
Yeah, no, if you ever lose her, Bob, I'm coming, you know, don't screw up now.
Don't. Don't you be telling me that this whole gay thing was a big ruse
get to your wife.
It was a complicated scam that you've been working on for decades.
Decades, that's right. That's right. It's the only reason Bob lets me talk to her. I love her so much. I really do. I don't know if many of you have had the pleasure of talking with Agnes, just one-on-one or even in a group. She's just the sweetest person in the world. And I've never met her in person. I came close one day in West Virginia, and I didn't look out the window of my train because I didn't realize what stop we were at, and I really regret that. And I am still hoping to meet her someday in person. But just the sweetest voice in the world. She's got this great little southern accent. It's just, I don't know, it just could melt snow.
Well,
anyway,
yeah,
I don't know why.
She's so bright and sunshiny. She walks by tulip beds and tulips say, oh, the hell with it, and just give up.
Well, you know, you need it, Bob, because you're a bit of a pessimist, I got to say. Sorry. But I can understand why you can survive.
Yeah, but to the extent that Obama is the happy warrior, Agnes is the happy pessimist.
Exactly. Well, no, she's a happy optimist.
No.
She says negative things about people, but she seems
her glass is half empty a lot of the time. But she seems to be happy about it.
All I can say is when I hear her complain, and she does complain about things. Listen, you got some tough things that go on day to day, and I'm proud that she trusts me enough to share some with me. She always makes me smile. I don't know how she does that, even when she's telling me some awful thing. I don't know. Anyway, again, I don't know how we got on your
right,
life.
Well, I got to salute her. Because you know why we got on to talking about my lovely wife? Because because the fact of the matter is, we're talking about this convention that has largely been pitch perfect so far.
Yeah.
And what it inspires us is to reflect back on the qualities of our own families. Because, who was it? Dostoevsky that said all happy families are happy in the same way, but dysfunctional families are unhappy families are unhappily are unique in their unhappiness or whatever. And it causes us to reflect on the fact that if we stand together, working people, middle class people, people struggling to come into the middle class, lower class, whatever words you want to use, but if ordinary people, or the phrase I like to use is extraordinary people, because truly, it's a lot. It takes a lot more guts to be to be regular and middle class or working class or whatever than it does to sit there and clip coupons. If we stand together and decide that we want a better America, we have it within our power to make it, Mark. And I think that's what
Bob,
was reflected.
This is about the most optimistic I've ever heard you.
That's what
this
was reflected.
The Bob I know. No, the Bob I know is complaining about, you know, the Bush administration and Roe and Cheney, and I don't often hear this hope. Obama has infected you, Bob. He has. You have got the virus.
I'll get cured.
Even Bob Kincaid can be hopeful.
Sure, I can.
Possible.
Sure, I can. And a lot of my bad attitude was handed to me on a vile, toxic platter in December of 2000.
Yeah, I know. Me too.
I mean, I remember. I mean, I can almost. We were passing the newcomers town Gnadenhütten exit of I-77 southbound, coming back from Cleveland Clinic, my father and I, and we were listening to the arguments before the Supreme Court.
December 11th, 2000. I saw every bit of it.
And I sat there driving along. My dad's in the passenger seat. We're coming back from Cleveland Clinic. They had just gotten done saving his life. And he looked at me and he said, I don't know anything about the law, but it sounds like those son of a bitch Republicans don't have a leg to stand on. And I said,
and they didn't.
And I said, they don't, Dad. But the fix is in. He says, "Oh, you mean that there's a whole bunch of Republicans that are going to screw us?" I said, "That's exactly what I mean, Dad." And he said, "It's what they do." And from
well,
that,
I will,
and it's,
I will confess to being optimistic. I will confess to actually believing in the law. I will confess to believing that this couldn't happen in America. I was naive. I admit it, and I was stunned when it happened. It changed my life.
Mark, were you really stunned?
You know, I was. Okay. When I started to feel the fix was in on December 9th, 2000, when I read Scalia's wonderful, we can't count the votes, because if we count the votes and it says that Gore won, then we'd have to recount. So we have to have the hearing before we count the votes. I mean, that's what the December 9th opinion says. Read it for yourself, folks. If you haven't read, this isn't the long one. This is a two-page opinion on why we can't count the votes before we have the hearing. Well, read it. It says, if we count the votes and Bush doesn't win, then we'd have to recount them. And, okay, I got suspicious then.
Right, and at that point in time, you're shaking your heads and you feel like you hear gravel rattling.
Well, but I felt like I know the law. I know the Constitution. There are ambiguous points where the Supreme Court can decide one thing or the other, but this is unambiguous. They can't do this. They have no power under the law to do this. And then they did.
Yeah, they did, and again, you talk about the Depression. You know, I guess this is Horn on the Couch Hour or something.
It's what I think we're in psychology here,
but. That's another factor in it, just slapping America, the majority of whom voted for Al Gore, remember. Easy to forget that.
And the majority in Florida, let's not forget that.
Slapping America in the face with the fact that, by God, the rubber mask was off, the curtain had been pulled back, we were seeing the wizard working the knobs, and just slapping America in the face and saying, you're... vote doesn't count. Sit down and shut up. And there were, and I'm sure you were one of them, Mark. I know I was, who were sitting there, you know, screaming, Gore, fight back. For the love of God, fight back. Don't you understand the stakes? You know, don't you see what? Please fight back. And so
there were 100 calls to his campaign. I sent emails. Listen, I know some people. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the right wing thugs surround the Naval Observatory in D.C., the vice presidential residence, and they're screaming at the top of their lungs, "Get out! Get out! Get out!" And you've got the riot going on that's comprised entirely of right wing congressional staffers down in Dade County. And you're just sitting.
Couple more things. First of all, they said, get out of Cheney's house, was the chant.
Yep.
I remember that.
Yep.
And secondly, those Republican staffers were Tom DeLay staffers, most of them.
Well,
and the others were gotten by Tom DeLay. It was a manufactured riot.
Well, let's see. Who's that crazy bastard from Indiana? Dan Burton.
Which one?
Dan Burton.
Oh, yeah.
There were his staffers there. One of the handiest resources out there is there's a photograph, Mark. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there's
a
photograph of
the numbers.
Yeah, with the numbers that tells you exactly who they are and whose congressional staff they came from.
I have seen
that was a felony, Mark. That was a felony in virtually any state in the union.
Yes.
No charge.
But not in Florida, because Jeb Bush was governor.
Precisely. And because Catherine Harris was. The
chair of the Bush campaign for Florida,
and Secretary of State, and Mary Kay sales lady in chief. So you know that's where all that comes from. And so by then, by the time you get to 2004, and everybody knows in their hearts of hearts, everybody knows that Ohio has been, you know, Floridized.
Right.
And John Kerry walks away. Even with John Edwards sitting there screaming, that's why they're not very good friends anymore, screaming at him, how dare you, how dare you, you stand up and fight. And John Kerry walks away with $45 million of people who sent in $5 and $10 at a time, walks away with $45 million in his war chest, and plenty of money to fight for an honest recount, and won't.
Bob, you're depressing me again.
No. What I'm trying to lead up to, though, is the fact that we have a chance, Barack Obama has a chance to erase all of that.
Well, he'll never erase it, but let's just say transcend it.
He can get the political zeitgeist monkey off our backs. And I so want that to happen, because among other things, Mark, I have a vested interest. I want to pass a belief in the political system of this country on to Agnes and my children.
I used to have that belief. You know what? I still do, damn it. They haven't beaten it out of me yet. Now,
precisely my point.
If McCain wins, I might just have to do the Stockholm Syndrome and, I don't know, move to Canada or something. But the reason I entered talk radio 5 years ago, and it's been 5 years, and it doesn't seem like 5 years since I last worked in the administration. I want to work in the administration of Obama, last worked in Congress. But the reason I entered talk radio was because I did not lose hope, and I kept seeing, and I was there in all the early Bush years, 01, 02, 03. When I started in talk radio, George Bush had an 80% approval rating. I know that seems impossible to believe.
I remember it, too. Of course, I remember when George Bush the first started the first Gulf War and had a 96% approval rating, and I was sitting there with my little forehead in my hands going, oh, we'll never get rid of this bastard at this rate.
And I was screaming metaphorically, although somewhat loud. You know, I can raise my voice in a microphone from time to time. Screaming, the emperor has no clothes. He's lying to you. There are no weapons of mass destruction. They're manufacturing evidence. I didn't use those words, the words of they're fixing the facts around the intelligence at the time, because I didn't have the Downing Street memo. But I have listened back. You know, I've done it a couple times. At some point, I need to replay my very first show in June 2003. Because at that time, I said Cheney is changing the intel. And, you know, I don't remember reading about that in the New York Times till what, 2-3 years later?
Oh, I know.
But I knew it. I heard it. It wasn't just
I was talking about the
knew it.
In Beckley, I was talking about the outing of Valerie Plame in June of 2003. And you're crazy. That never happened. You know, it only took a couple of years for that to... So, you know...
That's why I went to talk radio. That's exactly... I mean, that's why I named my show The Inside Scoop. Because I wanted people to know that it's not what they're telling you on the outside. There is an inside scoop, and it ain't pretty.
Exactly. And let's go to the phones real quick, Mark.
Sure, absolutely.
Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, Gary. How about you, man?
All right. What's going on?
You know, we're sitting here bathing in the warm glow of a little bit of optimism.
That's what I called, man. When I heard that Bob Kincaid was starting to get optimistic, I said, I got to call Bob tonight.
It's a rare event. Enjoy it.
Because I've been working on him. Trust me, I've been working on him.
Yes, you have. Yes, you have.
You know, I've tried my best, because I've been the most cynical person in the world for years, and I've been going through that struggle, you know. Because that cynicism is a double-edged sword.
Well, it is, but you know, when you see and hear what we have seen and heard, you look at that precious, precious, beautiful family, and Gary, you can't help but ask, how could anybody in this country reject that in favor of a guy who went running around on his first wife, abandoned her to a crippling injury, let some other guy pay her medical bills, and then ran off with a millionaire beer heiress. How can... It ought to be a landslide.
Yeah. Well, I can say this.
Bob, America doesn't know that story, Bob. They don't know it.
But I can tell you that people in my family who are not really politically astute, and I can tell you now, maybe it's because it's an African-American, but I've seen it with some young people, because I've been working with some of the Democratic campaigns now, getting out the vote. And I meet a lot of young people, and they're really the ones who really give me the optimism. I'm still very cynical about what may happen, but I feel like when I'm out there and I see them, they're fired up and they're motivated, I feel like I'm being a traitor if I don't do all I can to try to help the Democrats win.
Yes.
You know, and that's just how I feel about it, you know, at this point.
You know, I think that is the young-old divide in this election, and it's one reason why the young... so for Obama, and a lot of elderly people, frankly, still aren't. It's exactly that cynicism versus optimism. If you're younger than 30, then you feel like, okay, we've always known as George W. Bush. We can do better. We can have a change. We can win an election. If you're, I don't know, 30 to 50, then you're in between optimism and pessimism. It's like, well, they stole it from us. Remember 2000? We started to be optimistic, and it was taken from us But, you know, we remember Bill Clinton, and there was an optimistic time, and so we're kind of in between. And then the elderly people, I think many of them are just sort of cynical. They've just seen too many politicians come around and too many slick things happening, and they're just like, eh, he can't mean it. He's too good to be true. He must be a phony. And I think that's what people think about Obama, that are many of them. He's too nice. He's too cool. He's too good looking. He's got too good a family, too good in education, too good in the American dream story. He must be false because nobody's that good.
But you know what? That's the success of the Republican attack strategy, isn't it, Gary?
Yeah.
Because
they. I see another thing on that. I'm seeing the opposite side because, like I said, there are people in my family, people I'm working with, and people like Steve I talk to, who I know a couple of years ago when Bush came to office, these people were not politically aware. They didn't know the issues. And I can tell you, these people are now starting to know the issues. They're actually talking because they're so interested in Barack Obama. They're getting a little bit more interested in politics and the way things work. And I think that, you know, my thing is I'm just not, like, overly flabbergasted with, like, really any candidate because I know the politics of Washington. But I think the awakening has to come from the bottom up. And that's what really attracted me to Howard Dean and Obama's campaign. It's not really the candidate. It's the way they're running the organization from the grassroots up. You know, I told Bob this many times. That's where I think the country has to be fixed from the bottom up. It's not going to, we can't just count on government to do it. They're not going to do it. It's got to be us, people in our, you know, in our party and people in America just get more politically aware and say, you know what? Drilling right now doesn't make sense. You know, America has to really get smart politically because the politicians and the system is corrupt. And that's the only way it's going to change. America has to change. And I think that's what Barack Obama, not the candidate, but the movement in the camp, I think is kind of offline. And I think that's why we need to seize it. You know, I mean, at least that's how, you know, that's how I feel about it. So.
And what we're feeling here, I think, is the fact we recognize that energy flows in two directions, Gary. It flows from them on the stage there in Denver to us, but we also can have it flowing in the other direction. And I don't like being a political cynic. I'm sure you don't like in yourself, either one of you, Gary or Mark. But I have been trained to that, and I have been trained to that at the tip of a whip for the last 8 years. And I'm ready to bust free. I don't know about y'all, but I am.
Well, you know, it's like Peter and Paul. I mean, Paul was, you know, whatever. You know, if you look at it that way, I want to make my own biblical reference. But, you know, I think you have to have people stand guard and keep an eye on them. You got to have policemen, you know what I mean? But then you got to have the people who will go out there and spread the message and who are very cheerful. So I think this is a place for everybody. In it. I don't think being cynical, I think being cynical is good, but somebody got to keep an eye on Karl Rove. I think the problem with the Democrats sometimes, they just are so, like, naive about how things are. Oh, no, they won't do that. And I'm like, oh, yes, they are going to do that. They're going to steal the vote, and they're going to do all this other stuff. So I think we do need a healthy dose of both. I don't think we should be, like, you know, following, you know, the Pied Piper, but I think we also, you know, we should be, you know, very critical of our leaders, but we also need to be there with hope.
Absolutely, and hope defines the fact that we know that with McCain, we get absolutely more of the same.
Gary, this, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was just going to say, Gary, that I want you to notice something. I want all the Horn listeners to notice something. Maybe y'all already did, but there have been some attacks on McCain tonight. Every single one of them was policy oriented. Not a single Democrat even mentioned the seven homes, which I think is a perfectly fair thing to mention. I mean, he has them, and he doesn't know how many he has. No one's even mentioned that. Every single attack thus far, I'm kind of looking forward to the more vicious ones, but every attack thus far has been about his policy, about the fact that, you know, he's against health care for poor Americans. He wants to keep the troops in Iraq for 100 years. He doesn't believe in diplomacy. Every single attack has been about policy. I guarantee you both, and I'm sure you both will agree with me, come next week, every attack on Barack Obama will be personal. Maybe not everyone, most of them. Most of them will be personal.
And they're going to be vicious.
Yes. They will.
So you know what? We need
elitist
a little
elitist and arrogant and all that stuff. You didn't hear anybody. You heard Joe Biden and John Kerry both say John McCain is my friend, but his positions have changed. They will harm America and they'll bankrupt us. Every attack on McCain was fair. Every single one. You know, Bob and I maybe have gone a little bit. We've talked about personal things. Not at this convention. It's all been, and it won't be that way next week. I guarantee it.
No. They're gonna open a floodgate, and it's just gonna be pure toxic sleaze that comes out. But Gary, this is, you know, that's what the purpose of this is. It's to kind of gird us up, you know, to put a little armor on for when this happens. But when it happens, I hope that they will punch back hit me once, I punch you twice. I mean, is that fair?
Yeah. Before this thing is over with, the Republicans will be using the N-word. Somewhere down the line.
Only in private, Gary. They may be caught. I hope they're caught on the microphone. They'll be using it a lot, but mostly away from the microphones.
If they get caught on the, if any high-ranking Republican gets caught on the microphone using that word, it's over.
Nah, McCain will just say, look, I fire him from the campaign. I had no idea he was like that. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and that's where we Mark Furman him. I remember Mark Furman. You guys remember Mark Furman?
Yes, we all remember O.J. Simpson's police
officer.
He
had a big stiff, and he disappeared and ended up on Fox.
Yeah, oh, that's true. That's true. I'd forgotten that.
Hey, wait a minute. Maybe Fox is hell. You know, every evil person ends up there.
I did switch over to the sickness for a few minutes to watch the coverage, and they had Karl Rove sitting up there. Meanwhile, while John Kerry is, like, ripping into him, and he's sitting there making commentary, like, I'm thinking to myself, this guy should not be in the booth. A person, a criminal, or even if you want to get past all of that.
He should be in jail.
He should be in the dock, not the booth.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, he shouldn't be on Fox as a commentator. What the heck is, I mean, this me? How is he on Fox, the guy who's the main political operative for George Bush and now John McCain? What is that about? Why isn't he in the shadows? I mean, I don't
Gary,
understand what's going on.
Reread 1984 by George Orwell.
That's it. Yeah.
And you know why Rove is in the booth. I mean, it's classic.
Now, you need to explain to me, because I'm still kind of like, explain to me word for word what you mean. It sounds like a quick sentence. Why he's in the booth, because I really don't understand.
I'll be happy to. I'll go back to literature. George Orwell's 1984 described a leader who had perpetual war. It wasn't always clear who the enemy was. The leader would keep switching them, and there was an enemy that everyone would hate and yell names at, and that enemy could change from time to time. And so you have perpetual war, perpetual enemy, and then you'd have the slogans, war is peace, war is peace, ignorance is strength, freedom is slavery. And then they would program people to say all those things. And one of the ways they would do it is they would have in the media, people who would require you to say these things. And they'd actually have cameras watching you while you watch the TV show to make sure that you mouthed along with everybody, you know, war is peace, ignorance is strength, freedom is slavery. And the Bush administration, now spying on 200 million Americans, putting up things like the Fox propaganda channel, and yes, putting their operatives in it, and trying, it's all about what Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propagandist, said in 1935. He said, you know what, a little lie is easy to dispute, but a big lie is much harder. A little lie, you know, did you drive over the speed limit? Well, you know, we got radars, whatever. You can prove that one way or the other. But a big lie, you know, Obama's a Muslim, or they have weapons of mass destruction, or Al Qaeda's in league with Iraq. I mean, that's such a big lie that, well, then even when we disprove it, they're like, well, maybe they did. Maybe they're just hiding the weapons. Maybe Obama's a secret Muslim. Maybe Al Qaeda was in league with Iraq. We just don't know it yet. You see, a big lie is virtually impossible to disprove. The Republicans are following the Nazi playbook. And George Orwell knew about the Nazis. Knew about the communists, and he wrote 1984 with them in mind. And whenever I see the Bush administration, I pull out a copy and try to figure out what they're up to.
Yeah, yeah. But see, what I'm saying is, But why does he have to be on TV himself? Why doesn't he have somebody else while he's in the background doing those things? I mean, he's been doing that for years. That's how he's been operating. And all of a sudden now he's front and center. That's what I'm trying to understand. I can't really figure out.
It's to make him seem like not a criminal. It's to make him seem like an ordinary human being.
That's what I was thinking. But I just was not convinced of my own thinking of it. I just want to hear somebody else say that because that's what I was thinking. It's like Robert Novak. It's like, you know, as soon as something happens to him, he disappears all of a sudden, you know. I'm not saying he didn't get a brain tumor, but it's kind of strange that it happened at the same time. And then Rose, you know, you ever notice how Scooter Libby or all those guys, whenever they're going to a trial, it's like they end up like they got like some kind of a leg injury or something and they're walking on crutches? You just notice that. And I'm always saying, you're trying to get some sympathy. You know, that's what I'm always thinking in my paranoid way. I'm like, why is he, you know, on crutches? Why is Scooter Libby on crutches all of a sudden? You know, oh, here it is, foot. Oh, okay. You know?
One of the funniest things that Rove has done is, I mean, it's not funny, but I guess you have to laugh, is, the you know, John Conyers has called him, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, got a vote, got a subpoena, and Karl Rove is ordered by congressional order to appear before Congress. And he just says, no, I'm not going to do it. And it's an order, and he can't refuse. And Rove says, nah, sorry, you know, don't want to. But Rove said, you know what I'll do, John Conyers? I'll meet with you off the record without a court reporter, without an oath to tell the truth, and I'll talk to you. Don't penalize me for lying, and I promise I will lie to your face. Is that okay? And he expects people to buy that?
Well, you know, it's like, the character Winston in the book. It's like the rat trap thing on him. And he kind of like, that's really just what freaks him out. I'm just wondering, have they put the rat trap on the American people to scare them so much that they finally just give away all their freedoms, and I see it yet personally, but you know, maybe.
Well, that's what I fear. That's what the whole terrorist stuff is, right? I mean, it's all you be scared. They're gonna get you.
And now it's Russia.
Give us all these powers. Give us absolute power. Let us spy on you.
Let me throw that out there. My moment of just can't get rid of all of it. Not all at once, at least. There was a reference to some of that in the speeches tonight. Do you think that with proper executive, literally leadership, we have the political will in the face of what we know is coming from the right-wing controlled media, and I don't just mean talk radio, I mean it all, because we all know that corporate America is, we know who controls them and they control the airwaves. Do the Democrats in Congress have the political will to fix all the things that have been busted for the last 8 years, whether it's habeas corpus or FISA or voting rights, election legislation? Do they have the political will to do that under an Obama presidency?
I really think they do. I think a lot of the people that have criticized Nancy Pelosi, and I see them all the time. I talk to them all the time. Many of them are our listeners. I see them. And listen, I'm not saying she's been perfect. I got many problems. But
Gary, what about you?
They don't understand the institutional constraints.
I think she has to go.
Mark?
Take away her constraints, her institutional constraints. Take away the filibuster. Even if we don't get 60, we could probably do it with 58, but 60 would be perfect. Take away those constraints. Give us the power of government, and I think that even the skeptics will be surprised at how far the Democrats will go. I really do. Now, you know, you may not get everything
Gary,
you want.
Gary, your thoughts, please.
Impeachment is never off the table. This is where I become like the far left thing. Now, I know I criticize people for getting on the positive thing too hard, but impeachment is never off the table. It is. As I told Bob before, he is always on the table to the president, looking his ass in the face to make sure he do the right thing. You never take it off the table. You don't even say that. And I can't. And she continually just knocked it down. I mean, I can understand like her maybe want to push it to the side, but it was very clear John Conyers. I saw him in a speech in D.C. about 2 or 3 years ago, right after the Iraq invasion, and he was clearly indicating that he was going to pursue it. And Nancy Pelosi beat him down. I don't care what anybody says, he was beat down from pursuing that strategy. And Dennis Kucinich and all these other people have been pushed aside because the Democrats are so afraid of losing everything. And when they do that, they always lose everything. They should have had impeachment on the table. They should have weakened President Bush so much that this election would have been so easy for Barack Obama that Bush would have been so crippled he couldn't do anything. What's the best way to really destroy President Bush? Expose him, not to cover him up. I mean, I don't understand the Democrats and their strategy. And now, again, this is the far left side of me talking. Not saying I'm right. That's just my opinion.
You know, I've argued for several years now, probably back since 2005. I'll have to check my website to see when I first argued for the impeachment of Bush and Cheney. There's no question in my mind that both of them have committed high crimes and misdemeanors. And yet, this is the part where I usually get all the negative comments in the chat room, but I'll do it. I'll say it. Nancy Pelosi was making a political decision. It was her belief.
No,
and
how could it have been anything but? I mean, it was cynical political calculus. Gary, let me ask you another question, if I may, please. Given the conversation we're having, what do you think of the fact that, and you know, it's not breaking news or blockbuster stuff. What do you think of the fact that Kucinich's speech last night was censored?
Well, it took out one line, from what I understand.
Yeah, the line was, they want 4 more years, they should get 10 to 20.
I don't see what's wrong with that line. I'm sorry. What is wrong with that line? Now, I know you got to say, well, he don't have evidence to make that kind of statement.
Oh, I think we do have evidence to make that kind of statement. I think we're all on the same page on this one. We got plenty of evidence they should be in there, 10 to 20 or 20 to life, maybe.
I think, but, you know, I'll say this. You know, I'm going to say this in Nancy's defense. I mean, because I like Nancy Pelosi when she first came in. I was all for her. But, you know, I'm not really a big fan of her, and I think they cave in too much. They don't stand at the right time. And they really disturbed me because I think Bush did a lot more damage than he could have if they had just kind of, you know, pretty much kept him in a little bit of a box. You know, it's like isolating Saddam. They should have did the same thing with Bush. They should have tried to isolate him.
But well, Gary, actually, I'm going to stand up a little bit for her again, because if you look at the last 2 years, actually Bush has not done in the last 2 years the as awful things as he did in the first 6. I mean, he's still doing bad things, but they have constrained him somewhat. I mean, most of the really awful things we hate occur. I mean, you know, the torture, the warrant, the wiretapping, the holding Americans in prison without trial, the war. I mean, most of that occurred under Republican Congress. I think that Nancy Pelosi is a classic. It's like Bob said, political calculus. She counts votes all the time. That's what you do when you're Speaker of the House. And the Democratic majority is not large enough. They're blue dog Democrats. There are Democrats out there. They don't have a progressive majority. They have a Democratic majority. And she counts votes, and she says, well, if I can't get 218, we have to back down. That's what she does. And so if you want to blame her, she certainly gets her share of the blame. But some of it is institutional. If we elect more progressive Democrats, she will have an easier time doing the right thing. That's all I'm saying.
And Mark, Bob will tell you, what you're saying is the same thing that I've actually been saying. It's not like I
– It is.
It pretty much is. It's just that I have my little peeve with a certain thing. But, and as I told Bob, I said, but now I don't want to really get into talking, but then, you know, then, especially right now at the convention or anything, because we've got to really focus on getting Barack Obama and the Democrats in power. And then we'll work on progressive people like Nancy Pelosi. We have to either move her in the right direction or move her out. If you call
move her or call, remove her.
Yeah, remove her. Whatever.
I think y'all will
be. We got to do.
I think y'all will be surprised at the Nancy Pelosi you see under President Obama, Vice President Biden, and a Senate of at least 58 Democrats.
Lord, don't I want you to be right.
I think you will see that Pelosi is not
Mark,
as bad
I'm not
going to
be surprised. I already know that she's going to do the right thing. My point being was that it's just like Obama moving off of Pfizer to move. I know why he did it, but I guess what my point is saying is that I know where they're going to move once they got the power. I know what Nancy Pelosi is about. I knew she was a good person. She wanted to do the right thing. I saw her when, you know, when she was dealing with Bush with the war. You know, I think what me, you know, and I know Bob has kind of said this. It's like we sometimes disagree that they have to cave all the time for political positions. And they lose support sometimes. I mean, because when they do that, like Barack really took, I think, a big hit when he moved on Pfizer. He should have moved on the drilling stuff. That was fine. He should have moved on Pfizer. But, you know, we have to look at his point. And just, you know, when he gets in power, I think he'll do the right thing, the constitutional lawyer.
Well, guys, I hate to interrupt, but we do need to close up shop and so forth. John Fox is on the way, and Gary, thank you very much for the scintillating conversation. Because
I really appreciate
this may be the most important part of the measure of success for this convention. It's not whether people walk out of the Pepsi Center all fired up. If they don't, they're dead. But we, at a distance, what it does for us is what matters. So you know, I'm glad you are on an optimistic swing, and frankly, I'm glad I am too. But I really appreciate it, Gary, and have yourself a wonderful evening. All right.
All right, man. You guys have a good night. Bye, Mark.
Bye, Gary. Thanks so much. I'll tell you, you know, when I hear all this, I don't know the right political calculus. I'm just saying it is political calculus. You know, it may be the wrong decision. There is a point where you back down so much that suddenly you're doing it all for political reasons, but suddenly where are you? I mean, if you back down too much, then suddenly you're not who
you
are.
Oh, Mark, we could do another 3 hours on that topic alone. And you know, is part of the Republican strategy, part of the Republican cynicism, the fact that they know that they stand a strong chance of handing the same powers that they've given to George Bush to a Democrat, and does that make their bowels turn to absolute water? You're damn right it does. And for that reason alone, they will scratch, claw, kick, scream, gouge, kidney punch, rabbit punch, whatever, to keep us from getting a Democratic executive. Because all the good things they did for George Bush's power don't look so good in a Democrat's hands. But Mark, it's time for you to do the loadout, brother.
It is, because I'm only going to get about 2 or 3 more hours sleep tonight, and then I'm going to go tomorrow from about 3:45 a.m. till after midnight. And after that, if I make it home, I plan to sleep a lot.
I think you probably should. And you know, good luck with the TV gig tomorrow.
Thank you.
And stay in touch. Don't be a stranger.
Oh, don't worry.
All right, see you, Mark. Great job today, brother.
Take care. Thanks. I enjoyed it.
Bye now. So as the sun sinks slowly in the west, beyond the peaks of the mighty Rocky Mountains, we close a little bit of amazing broadcasting. We have done something here this evening and all day long. Guy James has. Mark Levine has. I have. You have. That proves, not just to the nation, but to the world, that there really is independent media in the United States, that not all opinion has been muzzled by the corporatists who control terrestrial broadcasting and the cable channels. And as the horn does every day, we have proven that it is possible, as long as people want it, to create this kind of media for you to participate in. Thank you for all your participation in the chat room, listening in, for your emails. For those of you listening, and whether it be at Phonostar, Receiva.com, iTunes, thanks to our buddies over at WD40.com for putting the player up there. Thanks to the folks, and I don't say this often enough, thanks to the folks at AfterDowningStreet.org for running our players there. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, the hardest working, bravest people I know. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.